Well, that was novel. So we don't have an intro this evening because suddenly the sound card is behaving strangely. Oh, there's nothing like being back in the home studio where odd things happen all the time. This is The Horn. You did not dial into the wrong program. It is Wednesday, the 29th day of January, 2020. And it's prayer meeting Wednesday. And let's see, the video card's misbehaving. The sound card's misbehaving. I'm not misbehaving. I just feel like crap. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid, and apparently there's something toxic about coming back to West Virginia because some sort of crud has gotten hold of me. And so I'm not exactly feeling what one would call my best. No. Not by a long shot. So we will do the best that we can. And I'll do the best I can to get through the next couple of hours. This is just strictly a matter of testing the functionality of the system right now. Okay, I've got a little bit of audio there. Question is, why didn't I have audio here? Nope, freezes up and dies. That's lovely. So we'll figure out a way. We'll figure out a way to get through this. Every program here at The Horn begins with gratitude, and thanks go out to our lone subscriber for the 29th day of the month. Thank you, Joseph. Thank you very, very kindly. And stepping into the breach and wiping out, and we finally met John's challenge. So glory hallelujah to that. Thank you to an anonymous contributor, and thank you to Kat in Ohio. Thank you very kindly indeed. Let's see. That means that, we've got a fundraising goal of just $200 for just the ordinary $200 this evening. So that's a tremendous, tremendous help. The deacons will be passing the plate. They just won't have the assistance of the minister of music to do that with this evening. And we'll probably, since we're in the question and answer phase of the impeachment proceedings, we'll probably be checking in on that as we go through the evening, these next couple or three hours, as I, frankly, I'm not, it's not a joke. I feel like dirt. Thank you, Dan, letting me know. The sound's great here on TuneIn. Hope you feel better. Thank you, Dan. Yeah, it's just a matter of getting through it all. Thank you. I'm sure Scott appreciates it. Gary writes in. Gary from Bellingham, Washington. I was listening to Tuesday's podcast and was profoundly saddened to hear of the demise of Scott's buddy Chirps. I would like to pass along my condolences to Scott. So sorry, my wife and I went through a similar circumstance 3 years ago with the sudden loss of our beloved rascal. Very similar situation. I'd appreciate it. Well, consider it done, Gary. Consider it done. Thank you very, very kindly for your kind words to our buddy Scott. What else? There's a shit ton of stuff to get to, but I got a great starting point this evening with Lady B. You know how I know we've crossed the Rubicon? When Adam Schiff has to bring up the "what if this was Obama" argument, because underneath all the "well, he's the president, we expect better from him," or even the fact that he is a Democratic president, is the obvious, what if it was the ginger president who engaged in this shit? What if Obama has officially become part of legal political discourse in this country, the standard for which we judge all political crimes? Hell, you might even be able to bring any argument to a screeching halt if you use it right. For example, teacher calls little Jimmy into her office. "Little Jimmy, we saw you break little Susie's scooter. You did that shit, but your parents feel like you shouldn't be punished. You can't possibly get away with this. What if President Obama had done this shit?" Little Jimmy thinks a minute and then concurs that President Obama probably would have been punished for this same crime. He recognizes his burden, and suddenly the weight of the world is heavy on his shoulders. He apologizes and promises to pay for a new scooter. The teacher is happy. We all go back to normal again. Just kidding. Little Jimmy isn't as educated, refined, and dignified as President Obama is, and, well, he's a fucking kid. He throws a tantrum, flips the teacher off, and storms out of the room. And he suffers no repercussions because his parents are rich. There's your Trump-Obama comparison. Obama was a teacher, and he did the right thing because he has emotional intelligence. He was flattered, honored, and respectful of his new role. Trump, on the other hand, is a spoiled-ass rich, a spoiled-ass brat bitch. He believes he deserves to be where he is, actual qualifications and emotional intelligence. Be damned. Right now, Obama's sitting in his tastefully appointed, probably 5 to 10,000 square foot home and saying, I told you so. Republicans obstructed, obfuscated, and gaslit the American public all throughout his entire presidency, and that same America let them get away with it. Now that we desperately need the rule of law to ultimately decide for us, we can't find it. We got to argue with these Republican fools that indeed up is not down and black is not white. Crawl out of your caves and into the sunlight, Republican senators. This is serious. And if you think your constituents or your base will protect you, think again. Non-voters are starting to pay attention. Shit's going to get real this November. Shaking my damn head. What if Barack Obama had done this? Really, though? That's the illegal measurement we're using? Are we missing the irony? Nah, says Lady B, not at all. We are so fucked. Yes, I'm afraid we are. We've sort of hit the nadir of these arguments, saying that because this is all fallback trenches. This is retreat. One trench back. Retreat, one trench back. Retreat, one trench back. At first they were saying, so what if he did it? Not impeachable. Maybe it would be impeachable if somebody else did it. And now, today, we have Alan Dershowitz, the guy who in 1974 said that he didn't like Nixon's gang being tried in D.C. by a bunch of blacks and liberals. Alan Dershowitz declaring that presidential action demanding... Get the hockey puck, for fuck's sake. Alan... Told you, I'm not feeling good. Nitwit Nero demanding a political hit job from a foreign country in aid of his reelection effort could be construed as something taken in the best interest of the United States and therefore would not be impeachable. You know what? It would take me at least a fifth of rot gut tequila to get to the point where I would say something that's stupid. But here we are, and there it is. Jesus. Yeah, I'm gonna try a restart so that we can on the fab machine, so that hopefully, we can access things like audio clips and the Minister of Music and all those things that we do so thoroughly love on this program, especially on. On a Wednesday. We shall see. In the meantime, however, before we check out before we check out into the audio or whatever from today's proceedings, and by the way, whatever this is, watch out for it. I got my flu shot, so we know what it ain't. But it comes with, you know, runny nose, headache that makes you feel like your skull's gonna, the top of your skull's gonna come off. I mean, it's a real joy. Agnes kindly made me a cup of decaf Earl Grey. Don't laugh at the decaf. And hopefully there'll be a little bit of respite in that. All right, let's see here. Hey, yeah, goody. So that being the case, brethren and sistren, we will get this prayer meeting Wednesday started. The little old blue-haired ladies were real busy in the, well, not exactly busy. They were just taken up watching the proceedings there of the 16 hours of senatorial questions. By the way, those 16 hours of senatorial questions, I noticed a couple of amazed maggots on, I think, Twitter earlier today saying, you know what? This is all planned. I done seed where that there Charles Schumer, he done corroborated with that there Adam Shifty Schiff, because he asked a question, and when he asked the question, Adam Shifty Schiff had video queued up for it. Oh, it's all planned. It's all fixed. Never noting, of course, that the same thing is happening on the Republican side. Nitwit Nero's lawyers know what questions are coming. This isn't some sort of pop quiz. Oh, no. Far from it. But the little old blue-haired ladies were quite taken with the proceedings, so they didn't get a hell of a lot of work done. And for the most part, they just put out a pile of toast and some pimento cheese spread and some pickles and said, do your best. We're busy today. The Republic is at hazard. This did not please the deacons even a little bit. And you do not mollify a deacon's desire for dessert with Jell-O pudding cups. Please believe me when I tell you that doesn't work. And so the deacons are surly as hell this evening. Yeah, they roared through a few four packs of the dark chocolate pudding and stomped angrily up the couple of flights of stairs and went out in the parking lot, and they were downright mean to the sinners. Give me a light. You got a smoke? Fuck you. I'm a deacon. And as a result, when Sister Carol Baker, Sister Carol with her solar-powered cattle prod is the only one who can really put the spirit, the spirit of the proceedings into the deacons. So they ambled insouciantly through the vestibule, past that desiccating bowl of butter mints, and wandered down front. They're standing around with, they got cigarette packs tucked in their t-shirt sleeves and chewing on matchsticks and grumbling, and they just want to pass the plate and get it over with. So we'll ask the minister of music forward and see if we can't knock out the fundraising goal real quick and get on with the program. So brother minister of music, if you would please.
And he said, it's time for you to leave behind the things of this world. The fine houses, the fancy cars, the flashy clothes. Because we are all naked in the eyes of the Lord.
Stop! This man is clinically insane.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, amen.
Amen.
Let me hear you say, praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
I will empty the contents of my wallet.
And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah! Praise the Lord for all the cash I've got. Praise Him for my Rolls Royce and my yacht. Serving God ain't hard with a credit card. Jesus died so I could make a lot. Praise the Lord, He's made us millionaires. Wave your donations in the air. We've replaced our hymns with ATMs, and soon we'll charge a fee on every prayer. Jesus Christ was a poor man, don't you know? He should have used our accountants for his cash flow. Stop the Sermon on the Mount, he should have had a bank account. 2,000 years with interest, he'd be rolling in the dough. Praise the Lord, this song's out on CD, just $40.95 plus GST. Hallelujah, plenty of moolah, solid gold baubles on my Christmas tree. I've got all of heaven's riches, thanks to all you stupid bitches. Praise the Lord for modern Christianity. Whoever said religion should be free?
Hot set roasting on the Rillerai and the brawl of Rolla Suet. I love you. Welcome, brethren and sister, to prayer meeting Wednesday on the Horn. I'm a calling on you now before we get busy with the civic duties that we have of paying attention to the impeachment sham trial perpetrated by Moscow Mitch. I'm a calling on you to get up onto your feet and out of your seat and come on down that blood red aisle. Wow, that hurt my throat. And fall upon your knees. Hout glory at the altar and lay your hands upon the subwoofer and feel the healing ouch rays of common sense are flowing through you from the server on high. I am Archpope, Uber Rabbi, Ultimate Imam, Animated Animist, Aggravated Agnostic, Maximum Metropolitan, Vicarious Vicar, Munificent Mullah, Bob Kincaid, and it is Prayer Meeting Wednesday on the Horn. Amen and amen. Brethren and sisters, as I said, the Republic is at hazard, as it has so often been during the timorous, tremulous times of the existence of this stumbling constitutional republic that likes to tell itself it's a democracy, but really has never been particularly good at that notion. Brother Deacon Steve with a note. Subject line, Dushowitz. So if the president seems it's in the national interest, he can do anything he wants. Therefore, if the president does it, that means it's not illegal. Yep, straight at it. It's the Nixon argument. The president is above the law. Wouldn't it be nice if these godforsaken Republicans would just say that and get over it? And let's just find out if the American people agree. Right? There will, by the way, probably be significant portions of pregnant pauses and dead air while I sneeze my fool head off this evening. So that's just a little heads up. But it would, you know, come on. Let's just have the anti-constitutional fucks just stand up and say, we want an absolute monarch who is above the law and need not ever be held to account unless he's a Democrat and or, you know, ginger. Because that whole what if Obama did it thing is a very real presence in all of this. Oh, without a doubt. And in point of fact, it was a as Lady B pointed out, it was a profound moment when Adam Schiff poleaxed him with that question. Let's go back to it.
The question is for the House managers. Would you please respond to the answer that was just given by the President's counsel?
I would be delighted. There are two arguments that Professor Dershowitz makes. One that is, I have to say, a very odd argument for a criminal defense lawyer to make, and that is, it is highly unusual to have a discussion in trial about the defendant's state of mind, intent, or mens rea. In every courtroom in America, in every criminal case, or almost every criminal case, except for a very small sliver that are strict liability, the question of the defendant's intent and state of mind is always an issue. So this is nothing novel here. You don't require a mind reader. In every criminal case, and I would assume in every impeachment case, yes, you have to show that the president was operating from a corrupt motive, and we have. But he also makes an argument that all quid pro quos are the same, and all are perfectly copacetic. Now, some of you said earlier, well, if they could prove a quid pro quo over the military, now that would be something. Well, we have. So now the argument shifts to all quid pro quos are just fine, they're all the same. Well, I'm going to apply Professor Dershowitz's own test. He talked about the step test, John Rawls, the philosopher. Let's put the shoe on the other foot and see how that changes our perception of things. But I want to merge that argument with one of the other presidential counsel's argument when they resorted to the whataboutism about Barack Obama's open mic. Now, that was a very poor analogy, I think you'll agree, but let's use that analogy and let's make it more comparable to today and see how you feel about this scenario. President Obama, on an open mic, says to Medvedev, "Hey, Medvedev, I know you don't want me to send this military money to Ukraine because they're fighting and killing your people. I want you to do me a favor, though. I want you to do an investigation of Mitt Romney. And I want you to announce you found dirt on Mitt Romney. And if you're willing to..."
Which is a pretty ballsy thing for Adam Schiff to do, because presumably Bishop Willard Romney was sitting right there in the room. Yeah, I know.
"Do that, quid pro quo, I won't give Ukraine the money they need to fight you on the front line." Do any of us have any question that Barack Obama would be impeached for that kind of misconduct? Are we really ready to say that that would be okay if Barack Obama asked Medvedev to investigate his opponent and would withhold money from an ally that it needed to defend itself to get an investigation of Mitt Romney? That's the parallel here. And to say, well, yes, we condition aid all the time, for legitimate reasons, yes. For legitimate reasons, you might say to a governor of a state, "Hey, governor of a state, you should chip in more towards your own disaster relief." But if the president's real motive in depriving a state of disaster relief is because that governor won't get his attorney general to investigate the president's political rival, are we ready to say that the president can sacrifice the interests of the people of that state, or in the case of Medvedev, the people of our country, because all quid pro quos are fine? It's carte blanche. Is that really what we're prepared to say with respect to this president's conduct or the next? Because if we are, then the next president of the United States can ask for an investigation of you. They can ask for help in their next election from any foreign power. And the argument will be made, nope, Donald Trump was acquitted for doing exactly the same thing. Therefore, it must not be impeachable. Now, bear in mind that efforts to cheat an election are always going to be in proximity to an election. And if you say you can't hold a president accountable in an election year where they're trying to cheat in that election, then you are giving them carte blanche. So all quid pros are not the same. Some are legitimate and some are corrupt, and you don't need to be a mind reader to figure out which is which. For one thing, you can ask John Bolton.
Oh! As Steve in New York notes, on a solemn and serious note, I'm very proud to be a Democrat after Adam Schiff et al. Have acquitted themselves so well. I'm doggone proud of them. Because this is, you know, there's that quote, and if you go to law school, probably on the first day of your first class, or in one of your first classes on your first day, or maybe at orientation, some stentorian white-haired professor will step to the podium and say, and he or she will say, "I want to remind you of the words once written by the late, great Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr." And he won't tell you about Oliver Wendell Holmes's racism or Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr.'s cocaine problem. He'll tell you that once upon a time, the late, great Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. declared, "It is possible to live greatly in the law." In hopes of providing a little bit of inspiration before they start teaching you the really tawdry shit that forms the basis of our so-called jurisprudence. But this is one of those moments. This is one of those "it is possible to live greatly in the law" moments. And Adam Schiff and his colleagues, the House managers, are doing so in big block bold letters. And I, too, am proud of them. And don't think for a minute that these Republicans don't know exactly what time it is. They know what the hell's going on. But they are cowards. They're chicken shits. They are in love with their own seats. They are in love with their own proximity to power. And as a consequence of that, they are willing to let Donald Trump get away with whatever Donald Trump wants, and the devil take the hindmost. That's where we are. Yeah, chicken soup wouldn't be a bad idea, Flavio. Chicken soup, Flavio suggesting you should have some chicken soup made with chicken feet, like my Portuguese grandma used to make. The best broth is made with the feet. And Flavio is not lying. Chicken feet are full of collagen and chickeny goodness. Flavio adds, "And when you're feeling miserable, there's nothing like the salty goodness of a chicken and rice soup made with the feet. It has truly medicinal qualities." I think there's been research done on it, and chicken soup, especially with garlic and black pepper in it, has certain antihistamine properties. Flavio, who I presume speaks from experience, I don't know, says it's also a great cure for a hangover when you can't bring anything else to your lips. Feel better soon. Thank you, Flavio. In that latter circumstance, my favorite is kimchi juice. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. But that's me. You know, lots of chili pepper and salt and tart, tangy, cabbagey, funky, fermented wonderfulness. Yeah. So, no, make no mistake. The Republicans know exactly what the hell they're doing. And it's merely a matter of them just not giving a good old-fashioned goddamn about the Constitution or the future. They are rooted firmly in the presence. No, I didn't go back to the 6 p.m. start time, Steve. I said we would have a talk about it when I got home. Steve from Georgia Stan says, "I thought you went back to your 6 p.m. start time. You have me all discombobulated, LOL. Yeah, we can have that conversation, but I think going – this slot, this 1 hour earlier, actually works out better because on those occasions when Mike and Kathy need me to fill in, it means we can get a full three-hour program in and still have the hour for turnaround to do Mike's show. I think I'm getting to where I kind of prefer it. So unless there's some sort of hue and cry for going back to 6 to 9, I think we may well stay here. And it looks like, from what I can tell, unless Brother Deacon Asa tells me something different, it looks like we have greater audience participation, at least in terms of listenership, if not keeping the program on the air, in this particular slot. So that's the nature of the discussion. Randy in PA says duck soup is better. Well, duck soup is all, if you're talking about the Marx Brothers movie, laughter is a healing thing, and duck soup is funny as hell. Other than that, duck is just not real prevalent around here. Although the neighbors do occasionally bring over some duck eggs, and you want to talk about yummy. They're a little bit bigger, they're a little bit richer, and if I've ever got a full collection of them, I'm going to do a plate of deviled duck eggs, and it's going to be fan-freaking-tastic. Let's pop over to the trial real quick and check out the issue therein at the suggestion of Brother Deacon Steve.
Deserves a fair trial. That includes Mulvaney. That includes Bolton. That includes other relevant witnesses.
A little slow on the up.
Manager.
Mr. Chief Justice.
The Senator from Alaska.
Mr. Chief Justice, I sent a question to the desk on behalf of myself and Senator Young and Senator Crapo. The question is to be directed to both parties.
Thank you.
So they turn the mics off until the old Balls and Strikes can get a copy of the question itself.
The question directed to counsel for the President and the House managers. The Constitution does not specify the standard of proof to be used in trials of impeachment, and the Senate has not adopted a uniform standard by rule. Thus, the standard of proof is arguably a question for each individual senator.
No, it
isn't. In the Clinton trial, and now with President Trump, it appears that Republicans and Democrats apply different standards depending on whether the president is a member of their party. What standard of proof should be used in trials of impeachment? Preponderance of the evidence, clear and convincing, beyond a reasonable doubt, and why? I think it's the turn of the House managers to go first.
I'm going to guess clear and convincing, because two-thirds of the Senate sounds like clear and convincing. That's definitely not beyond a reasonable doubt, and preponderance would be 50% plus one.
Court case on this. The House needs strong evidence, but it's never been decided beyond a reasonable doubt, as the President's counsel has suggested. And as the question notes, the Constitution does not specify either the House's evidentiary burden of proof or the Senate's. I would note that the House Judiciary Committee held itself to a clear and convincing standard of proof in the Nixon matter, which requires that the evidence of wrongdoing must be substantially more probable to be true than not, and that the trier of fact must have a firm belief in its factuality. In the Clinton case, the House did not commit to any particular burden of proof, and I would recommend against including an express standard. Instead, like in the Clintons, simply finding the facts and any inferences from those facts without legal technicalities. It has been opined that in the end, it is up to each senator to make a judgment. And I think there is much truth to that. Your oath holds you to a finding of impartial justice. And I trust that each and every one of you is holding that oath very dear to your heart. It will find the facts and lead to a just result for our country, the Constitution, and for a future that hopefully is as free as our past has been. I yield back.
Thank you.
Interesting, there was no reference to grand jury proceedings.
Mr. Chief Justice, Senators, thank you for the question. I think that the Constitution makes it clear in the terms that it speaks of impeachment.
Dude is wearing, this is one of the pettifoggers for Nitwit Nero. Dude is wearing a piss yellow tie. Tells you a little bit about the state of his courage, I think.
Except in the case of impeachment. And both that and the gravity of a presidential impeachment, which is an issue of breathtaking importance for the country and could cause tremendous disruption to our government, both counsel in favor of the traditional criminal standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And in the Clinton impeachment, senators, both Republicans and Democrats, repeatedly advocated in favor of that standard. Senator Russ Feingold then said that, quote, in making a decision of this magnitude, it is best not to err at all. If we must err, however, we should err on the side of respecting the will of the people. Similarly, Senator Barbara Mikulski then said, quote, the U.S. Senate must not make the decision to remove a president based on a hunch that the charges may be true. The strength of our Constitution and the strength of our nation dictate that the Senate be sure beyond a reasonable doubt. The preponderance standard is wholly insufficient. That means just 50.1%. You think it's a little more likely than not. That's not sufficient to remove the president. Even clear and convincing evidence is not. It has to be beyond a reasonable doubt. As Senator Rockefeller explained at the time of the Clinton impeachment, that means, quote, it is proven to a moral certainty the case is clear. That is the standard that the senators should apply, because the gravity of the issue before you would not permit applying any lesser standard.
Moral certainty, curiously enough, is not the same as beyond a reasonable doubt. The fact that they're talking about requiring two-thirds in order to remove speaks to the idea of clear and convincing, not beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the standard only for criminal trials. And as we've been told repeatedly, this is not a criminal trial. The previous question came from, was in regard to, did Mick Mulvaney waive executive privilege? Here comes the next question to old balls and strikes now.
The question is for the House manager. Even if a communication or a document is covered by executive privilege, that privilege can be overcome by showing the evidence is important and unavailable elsewhere. On January 22nd, while this trial was underway, President Trump said, quote, I thought our team did a very good job, but honestly, we have all the material. They don't have the material, end quote. Can you comment on whether executive privilege allows a president to conceal information from Congress, particularly if the evidence cannot be obtained elsewhere?
I'm surprised that there hasn't, at some point in time, we really do need to start making the claim, hey, Nitwit Nero, you want to tweet about this shit? Come down here, stick your hand in the air, and testify, you lying with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and I thank the distinguished senator from New Jersey for his question. President Trump alone has the power to assert executive privilege. And as the counsel admitted on Saturday, the president has not formally invoked it over any document requested in this impeachment inquiry. It's not been asserted as it relates to any single document. Now, executive privilege gives President Trump a qualified form of confidentiality when he does get advice from his aides in order to carry out the duties of his office. And as I know you are all aware, it is often the case in congressional investigations that a president will claim executive privilege over a very small subset of materials. In that case, what the executive branch usually does and should do is to produce everything that it can and then provide a log of documents in dispute or permit a private review of the documents that have been contested. That's not what has occurred in this case, because the president has ordered the entire executive branch to defy our constitutionally inspired impeachment inquiry. Blanket defiance is what has taken place. And there's no right to do that. Every court that has considered the matter has asserted that the president cannot assert a privilege to protect his own misconduct, to protect wrongdoing, to protect evidence that the Constitution may have been violated. The president cannot do it. In an impeachment inquiry, the congressional need for information and its constitutional authority, of course, are at its greatest. It's imperative to investigate serious allegations of misconduct that might constitute high crimes and misdemeanors. And that is what is before you right now. Let's look at what the Supreme Court has said in circumstances that are closest to what we face today in U.S. versus Nixon in the context of a grand jury subpoena. The Supreme Court found that President Nixon's generalized assertion of privilege must yield to the demonstrated need for evidence in the pending trial. And the federal court here in D.C. has recognized that Congress's need for information and for documents during an impeachment inquiry is particularly compelling. Turning to the facts of this matter briefly, any argument that every single document requested by Congress is subject to privilege or some form of absolute immunity is absurd. There are calendar invitations, scheduling emails, photographs, correspondence with outside parties like Rudolph Giuliani. These are all important pieces of evidence for you to consider and are not the type of materials subject to any reasonable claim of executive privilege. If you want a fair trial, it should involve documents. Given the nature of these proceedings, documents like Ambassador Bolton's notes, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's presidential decision memo should also be provided to you so you can seek the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Thank you, Mr. Manager.
Mr. Chief Justice.
Senator from Louisiana.
Senator Moran, my colleague from Kansas, and I send a question to the desk for counsel for the
Mr. Chief Justice, I have a question from the Moran. This one ought to be a Lulu because it's coming from Senator Jubilation T. Cornpone there, John Kennedy, who rubes up his dialogue for the folks back home, but who actually
question
went to
for counsel
Oxford.
For the president is, what did Hunter Biden do for the money that Burisma Holdings paid him?
Oh, I can answer that one too. Hunter Biden actually developed expertise through at both in law school and at his firm in corporate good governance. But here comes Pam Blondie
Bondi.
Thank
you for the question. Chief Justice.
Senators, as far as we know, Hunter Biden has said he, quote, attended a couple board meetings a year, end quote. Here's what we do know. Hunter Biden did attend one board meeting in Monaco. Now, we also heard that when Zolchevsky, the owner of Burisma, fled the Ukraine, he was living in Monaco. So Hunter Biden did attend a board meeting in Monaco.
Again, the Ukraine. This is proof that's not an accident. Ukraine is a country independent of Russia. The Ukraine is a provincial unit of old Russia. We know whose mindset these people are truly representing, because they continue to do that.
As much as we know, other than his statement that he attended one or two board meetings. Factually, that is what he said, and the timeline shows that, again, Devin Archer was on the board with him, and then Hunter Biden remained on the board, but factually in the record, that is as much as we know that he did involving Burisma and Zolchevsky. The Norway trip was June of 2015. He remained on the board.
And, of course, Pam Blondie-Bondi will not mention, as she desperately thumbs her way through her little notebook, she won't mention the fact that this is the 21st century and that one need not necessarily be present in a room in order to participate in the business of being on the board of directors of a corporation. There's stuff like email out there, and even old school put a stamp on it mail, and heaven forfend, fucking telephones and Skype and WhatsApp. But no, the woman who took $25,000 from Donald Trump to stay out of the Trump University lawsuit, no, she's not gonna bring that up, because she's as corrupt as the rest of the freaks are. And apparently Alan Dershowitz is actually sitting down there. He looks like he's either chewing on a toenail clipping or sucking his thumb. I can't tell at this great distance. Hey, thanks very kindly to Steve for getting us started this evening. Now the fundraising goal is only $180. Thank you very much, Steve and Miss Karen, little Cletus, little Twiggy.
The question reads as follows. The House managers say the president demands absolute immunity. The president's counsel disputes this. Can either of you name a single witness or document to which the president has given access to the House when requested? I believe it's time for counsel for the president to go first.
Here comes old urine
stain. Mr. Chief Justice, thank you, Minority Leader Schumer, for the question. And let me try to be clear and distinguish a couple of things. The House managers said there was blanket defiance. That's the way they characterize it. Just, we're not going to give you anything, and that's all we said. It was just blanket defiance. We're not going to respond. What I've tried to explain several times is that that was not the president's response. There were specifically articulated responses to different requests based on different legal rationales, because there were different problems with different subpoenas. So one problem is all the subpoenas up until October 31st were not validly authorized. So those subpoenas, we said, were not...
You know, according to the pettifoggers, were not validly authorized. Under the House rules, they were completely validly authorized. You'll notice he's not answering the goddamn question.
We subpoenaed, I think it was, they mentioned, Acting Chief of Staff Mulvaney after October 31st. That's true. We didn't rely on the fact that the subpoena was not authorized. We pointed out the doctrine of the absolute immunity of senior advisors to the president. This is not some blanket absolute immunity for the entire executive branch.
Why is it called absolute immunity, dumbass?
The subpoenas they issued. As we explained in our brief, it applies to three. There were three people they subpoenaed as witnesses that was on this basis alone that the president declined to make them available. Acting Chief of Staff Mulvaney, the legal advisor to the National Security Council, John Eisenberg, and the Deputy National Security Advisor, Mr.
Then why did Vindman and Fiona Hill have to defy the presidential order in order to go and honor the subpoenas that had been served upon them, huh?
There was a different problem with some of the subpoenas. Some of the other witnesses who were not senior advisors to the president the president did not assert that they had absolute immunity. Instead, those subpoenas refused to allow those executive branch personnel to have executive branch counsel accompany them. And there's an OLC opinion. It's been published. It's online. It's cited in our trial memorandum saying that it is unconstitutional to refuse to allow the executive branch personnel to have the assistance of executive branch counsel to protect privileged information during the questioning.
It.
And therefore, it's not valid to force them to appear without that.
Thank counsel. You, counsel.
Thank you.
That was table pounding, in case you were wondering.
Mr. Chief Justice and Senators, you know, we've received nothing as part of our impeachment inquiry. It's worth pointing out that the House committees that subpoenaed before the House vote had standing authority under the House rules, and they were the over.
If you are an impartial juror, when one side gets up and hems and haws and doesn't answer the question at all, and the other side gets up and answers your question in her first sentence, you have a right to consider that that lawyer is probably giving you the skinny while the other one is blowing smoke up your ass.
Immunity has never been upheld by any court, and it's really incomprehensible to think that somehow this concept of absolute immunity has lurked in hiding for centuries, for presidents to use it in this day. It's when you think of the two cases, the Myers case and the Gann case, courts completely rejected the idea of absolute immunity. On slide 38, if you could, there is a decision recently made in the McCann case, and here's what it says. Stated simply, the primary takeaway from the past 250 years of recorded American history is that presidents are not kings. That's the judge's words, not mine. Compulsory appearance by dint of a subpoena is a legal construct, not a political one, and per the Constitution, no one is above the law. The president is not permitted by the Constitution or by the law to assert any kind of absolute immunity. That does not exist in America. And as the judge has pointed out, that would be something that a king would assert. I'm not saying that, but I will say this. It's something our founders set up our checks and balances to prevent.
Meanwhile, old Balls and Strikes is up there, furiously jotting a note. Must remember to overturn judge saying president, not king, no absolute immunity.
And just wrong as a matter of law and as a matter of the Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you. Justice.
Senator from Georgia.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I send a question to the desk for both the counsel of the president and the House managers on behalf of Senator Cruz and myself.
Thank you.
This one will be a Lulu. I wonder if it's got any booger on it since Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz, the anointed booger-eating future king of America, was involved. Oh, well, there went dinner in the Eastern time zone. Read it to us, Balls and Strikes.
The question is, you refuse to answer the question on political bias. Are the House managers refusing to tell the Senate whether or not the so-called whistleblower had an actual conflict of interest? There are 7 billion people on planet Earth. Almost all had no involvement in Biden's quid pro quo. Are the House managers unwilling to say whether the so-called whistleblower was a fact witness who directly participated in and could face criminal or civil liability for Joe Biden's demanding Ukraine fire the prosecutor who was investigating Burisma? And why did you refuse to transmit to the Senate the Inspector General transcript? Which side is it's addressed to both sides. I think perhaps the House managers could go first.
That is a spurious, mendacious load of horseshit, that question is. And by the way, Stephen New York says, let's make this clear. There's no such thing as absolute immunity for anything in U.S. law. Nope. It's all qualified to one degree or another.
With respect to the ICIG, the President and his allies have tried to shift focus to the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, a highly respected veteran of the Justice Department and his handling of the whistleblower complaint. There was an effort to insinuate wrongdoing on the part of the whistleblower, and there's been an effort to insinuate wrongdoing on behalf of the Inspector General. The briefings that we had with the ICIG related to the unusual and problematic handling of this particular whistleblower complaint within the executive branch, which diverged sharply from any prior whistleblower complaint by anyone within the intelligence community. The Intelligence Committee is continuing its ongoing oversight to determine why and how this complaint was initially concealed from the committee in violation of the law. ICIG Michael Atkinson continues to serve admirably and independently as he is supposed to do. Like the Senate Intelligence Committee, the House Intelligence Committee does not release the transcripts of its engagements with inspector generals on sensitive matters because doing so risks undercutting an important mechanism for the committee to conduct oversight. The transcripts remain properly classified in conformity with IC requirements to protect sensitive information. The ICIG made every effort to protect the whistleblower's identity and briefed us with expedition, with the expectation, rather, that it would not be made public, and we are trying to honor that expectation. With respect to allegations of bias on the part of the whistleblower, let me just refer you to the conclusion of the Inspector General, which is, after examining the whistleblower, the whistleblower's background, any potential allegations of any bias, the whistleblower drew two conclusions. The whistleblower was credible, meaning that whatever issue, perceived or real, the Inspector General found that whistleblower credible. The Inspector General also found that the whistleblower's complaint was urgent and that it needed to be provided to Congress. The Inspector General further found that it was withheld from Congress in violation of the law, in violation of the statute. And for that, he is being attacked. Now, counsel for the President rely on an opinion of the Office of Legal Counsel as its justification for violating the Whistleblower Protection Act and not transmitting the complaint to Congress.
Thank you, Mr. Manager.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Senate, on page 5 of the Inspector General's report,
it's Jay Sokolode.
Although the Inspector General's preliminary review identified some indicia of arguable political bias on the part of the complainant. Now, that's in the actual statement. He goes on to say, involving a rival political candidate, such evidence did not change his view about the credible nature of the concern or the what appears to be credible. But to argue that it does not include an issue of political bias, the Inspector General himself says that that's, in fact, at least that they said that their preliminary views indicate some political bias. Now, there's been report.
He is, of course, a lying sack of shit, because even after the ICIG makes that finding that there may have been, he finds that it does not matter. That's what the whistleblower being credible means.
That managership just talked about the importance of how they control the process as it relates to whistleblower reports because of the sensitive nature of those. Do we not think that the sensitive nature of information shared by the President's most senior advisors should not be subject to the same type of protections? Well, of course, it has to be.
No.
Thank you.
He just tried to answer a previous question in that question. That's a mark of desperation.
Send a question to the desk for both the President's counsel and the House managers.
Oh, that was Joe Manchin's voice. This ought to be a Lulu, being as how Joe made a star turn on that My Filthy Morning Habit, wherein he declared that he thought Hunter Biden's testimony would be relevant. Sheesh.
The question from Senator Manchin reads as follows. The framers took the words high crimes and misdemeanors straight out of English law, where it had been applied to impeachments for 400 years before our Constitution was written. The framers were well aware when they chose those words that Parliament had impeached officials for high crimes and misdemeanors that were not indictable as crimes.
the House has repeatedly impeached and the Senate has convicted officers for high crimes and misdemeanors that were not indictable crimes. Even Mr. Dershowitz said in 1998 that an impeachable offense, quote, certainly doesn't have to be a crime, end quote. What has happened in the past 22 years to change the original intent of the framers and the historic meaning of the term high crimes and misdemeanors? It's counsel for or the president's turn.
This should be fun. Oh, and Alan Dershowitz
himself. What happened since 1998 is that I studied more, did more research, read more documents, and like any academic, altered my views. That's what happens. That's what professors ought to do.
So the law didn't change.
And I keep reading
Alan Dershowitz
and I keep
did.
Writing more, and I keep refining
and he
my
keeps
views.
Cashing the checks, and the checks
issue
keep clearing.
Before this Senate,
Dick.
Was not whether a crime was required. It was whether the crime that Clinton was charged with was a high crime. When this impeachment began, the issue was whether a crime is required. Actually, 2 years earlier in a book and then in an op-ed, I concluded, not on partisan grounds, on completely academic grounds,
bullshit,
that you could not impeach for abuse of power and that a technical crime was not required, but criminal-like behavior was required. I stand by that view.
The because the
framers rejected maladministration. That was a prime criteria for impeachment under British law.
Manchin didn't ask him
about
maladministration.
Remember, too, the British never impeached prime ministers. They only impeached middle-level and low-level people. So the framers didn't want to adopt the British approach. They rejected it by rejecting maladministration. And what's a metaphor or what's a synonym for maladministration? Abuse of power. And when they rejected maladministration, they rejected abuse of power.
Not really. It's not.
Mr. Congressman Schiff asked a rhetorical question. Can a president engage in abuse of power with impunity? In my tradition, we answer questions with questions. And so I would throw the question back. Can a president engage in maladministration with impunity? That's a question you might have asked James Madison had you been at the Constitutional Convention.
Like
and he would
Allen
say, no,
was.
A president can't engage right. in that with impunity, but it's not an impeachable crime. Maladministration is not impeachable, and abuse of power is not impeachable. The issue is
now
not whether
analyze the word maladministration.
The issue is whether abuse of power is a permissible constitutional criteria, and the answer.
This lying dirtbag. Abuse of power shares no etymological root with the word maladministration. Mal is Latin, and mal means bad. Bad administration. That's not that. That's fucking up. That's just fucking up. Abuse of power is something entirely different. Here comes Congressman Nadler. Turn his mic on.
To power. The first draft of the Constitutional Convention said treason or bribery. That was rejected because it wasn't inclusive enough. Somebody, Mason, proposed maladministration. Found too vague. So they said high crimes and misdemeanors. That was a well-understood term in English law. It was a well-understood term in the Warren Hastings impeachment going on in England right then. And it meant primarily abuse of power. That is the main main meaning of high crimes and misdemeanor. Charles Pinckney said those who behave amiss or betray their public trust. Edmund Randolph misbehaves. But I quoted Justice Story the other day. Every impeachment in American history has been for abuse of power in one form or another. The idea that you have to have a crime, bribery, is right there in the Constitution. Treason, bribery, are the crimes. Bribery was not made a statutory crime until 1837, so it couldn't have been impeachment. The fact of the matter is that crimes and impeachment are two different things. Impeachments are not punishments for crimes. Impeachments are protections of the Republic against the president who would abuse his power, who would aggrandize power, who would threaten liberty, who would threaten the separation of powers, who would threaten the powers of the Congress, who would try to arrogate power to himself. That is why punishment upon conviction for impeachment only goes to removal from office. Can't put him in jail, as you could for a crime. You can't fine him, as you could for a crime. There are two different things. An impeachable offense need not be a crime, and a crime need not be an impeachable offense. Two completely different tests, understood that way throughout American history, and by all scholars in our history, except for Mr. Dershowitz.
Ouch.
Thank you, Mr. Manager.
That'll leave a mark.
The senator from North Carolina.
Mr. Chief Justice, I send a question to the desk for the counsel of the president.
Now, is that Richard Burr or Thom Tillis? Not sure which.
Senator Burr asks, we've seen the House managers repeatedly play video clips of Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney's press conference in which they claim he said that there was a quid pro quo. How do you respond to the House manager's allegation that Mr. Mulvaney supported their claims in his press conference?
Nuh-uh. They don't claim he supported it. This is a question essentially giving the pettifoggers a chance to say, don't believe your lying eyes and ears.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Senate, Senator, thank you for the question. We respond as Mr. Philbin did earlier today with that, which is Mr. Mulvaney has issued two statements, one after his press conference and then one Monday after the New York Times article concerning Mr. Bolton's alleged statements in his manuscript. So I think the easiest thing is just to read them, to understand what he said and to put it into context for everyone in the chamber. This is from
context. This
is the day of the
press
conference. Once again, the media has decided to misconstrue my comments to advance a biased and political witch hunt against President Trump. Let me be clear. There was absolutely no quid pro quo between Ukrainian military aid and any investigation into the 2016 election. The president never told me to withhold any money until the Ukrainians did anything related to the server. The only reasons we were holding the money was because of concern about lack of support from other nations and concerns over corruption. Multiple times during the more than 30-minute briefing, where I took over 25 questions, I referred to President Trump's interest in rooting out corruption in Ukraine and ensuring taxpayer dollars are spent responsibly and appropriately. There was never any connection between the funds and the Ukrainians doing anything with the server. This was made explicitly obvious by the fact that the aid money was delivered without any action on the part of the Ukrainians regarding the server. There was never any condition on the flow of the aid related to the matter of the DNC server. Then, on January 27th, which was Monday, there was a statement from Bob Driscoll, who is Mr. Mulvaney's attorney. And I'll read it in its full. The latest story from the New York Times, coordinated with a book launch, has more to do with publicity than the truth. John Bolton never informed Mick Mulvaney of any concerns surrounding Bolton's purported August conversation with the president. Nor did Mr. Mulvaney ever have a conversation with the president or anyone else indicating that Ukrainian military aid was withheld in exchange for a Ukrainian investigation of Burisma, the Bidens, or the 2016 election. Furthermore, Mr. Mulvaney has no recollection of any conversation with Mr. Giuliani resembling that reportedly described in Mr. Bolton's manuscript.
This here is what you call hearsay. This is the real deal hearsay. If you want to know if he has no recollection, the only way to find that out is to get Mr. Mulvaney right there in front of the senators and let him say that to them in front of God and everybody. These guys are really not good at their jobs. That's what's going to make it so sad when the Republicans say, oh, we would have voted to convict the president, but his lawyers were so gosh dang dong good that we just had to bow to their superior legal skill. It's going to be sickening.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
So,
Mr. Chief Justice.
by the way,
Senator
that question
from Maryland.
Came from Burr.
Mr. Thanks, Chief Brian. Justice, I send a question to the desk for the President's counsel and the House managers. The question to both parties, the House managers will go first. What did National Security Advisor John Bolton mean when he referenced whatever drug deal Sondland and Mulvaney are cooking up on this, end quote, and did he ever raise that issue in any meeting with President Trump?
Mr. Chief Justice, Senators, when John Bolton, and this is according to Dr. Hill's testimony, brought up the drug deal, it was in the context of a July 10th meeting at the White House. There were two meetings that day. There was a meeting that Ambassador Bolton was present for, and then there was a follow-on meeting after Ambassador Bolton abruptly ended the first meeting. In the first meeting, the Ukrainians naturally wanted to raise the topic of getting the White House meeting that President Zelensky so desperately wanted. And after raising the issue, at some point, Ambassador Sondland said, no, no, we've got a deal. They'll get the meeting once they announce the investigations. And this is the point where Ambassador Bolton stiffened. Now, you can look up Dr. Hill's exact words. I'm paraphrasing here. But this is the point where Ambassador Bolton stiffens and he ends the meeting. Hill then goes, follows Sondland and the delegation into another part of the White House where the meeting continues between the American delegation and the Ukrainian delegation. And there it's even more explicit because in that second meeting, Sondland says, brings up the Bidens specifically. Hill then goes to talk to Bolton and informs him what's taken place in the follow-on meeting. And Bolton's response is, go talk to the lawyers and let them know I don't want to be part of this drug deal that Sondland and Mulvaney have got cooking up. So at that point, that specific conversation is a reference to the quid pro quo over the White House meeting. Now, we know, of course, from other documents and testimony about the quid pro quo about the White House meeting. And all the efforts by Giuliani to make sure that the specific investigations are mentioned in order to make this happen. But don't take my word for it. We can bring in John Bolton and ask him exactly what he was referring to when he described the drug deal. Now, did Bolton describe and discuss this drug deal with the president? Well, it certainly appears from what we know about this manuscript that they did talk about the freeze on aid. And whether John Bolton understood and at what point he understood that the drug deal was even bigger and more pernicious than he thought, that involved not just the meeting, but it involved the military aid, there's one way to find out. And I would add this in terms of Mr. Mulvaney. Thank you, Mr. Mulvaney. No, maybe I'll add it later.
Mr. Chief Justice.
As 2.5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Thank you, Senator, for the question. The question asks about what Ambassador Bolton meant in a comment that is reported as hearsay by someone else saying what he supposedly said. What we know is that there are conflicting accounts of the July 10th meeting at the White House. Dr. Hill says that she heard Ambassador Sondland say one thing. He denies that he said that. Dr. Hill says she went and talked to Ambassador Bolton, and Bolton said something to her about what was said in the meeting where he wasn't there, but he was saying something about it, calling it a drug deal. And what he meant by that, I'm not going to speculate about. It's a hearsay report of something that he said about a meeting that he wasn't in, characterizing it some way. And I'm not going to speculate about what he meant by that.
Thank you. The senator from North Dakota.
That there was kind of a confession.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I have a question for myself, also for Senator Portman and Senator Bozeman. And it's for the President's counsel, and I'm sending it to the desk.
Jesus. Oh, and by the way, Megan wrote earlier and said, I prefer the 5 p.m. time slot as far as this program is concerned. I leave work at 5.
The question from the senators is as follows.
Commute home.
In September of 2019, the security assistance aid was released to Ukraine. Yet the House managers continue to argue that President Trump conditioned the aid on an investigation of the Bidens. Did the Ukrainian president or his government ultimately meet any of the alleged requirements in order to receive the aid?
Quick answer, yes, because he was all set to go on CNN with, Fareed Zakaria, and do exactly as he was told to do, but it only ended when they got caught.
Mr. Chief Justice?
You know who'd be an interesting witness? Fareed Zakaria.
Thanks, Senator, for the question. And the very short answer is no. But I'll explain. And I think that's clear. And I think we demonstrated in our presentations on Friday and Monday that the aid was released, the aid flowed. There was a meeting at the UN General Assembly. There was a meeting previously scheduled in Warsaw, precisely as President Zelensky had suggested, and there was never any announcement of any investigations undertaken regarding the Bidens, Burisma, the 2016 election. No statements made, no investigations announced began by the Ukrainian government.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Chief Justice.
The senator from Virginia.
Mr. Chief Justice, I send a question to the desk for the House of Managers.
The question is, do you know about additional information related to Russia disseminating President Trump's or Rudolph Giuliani's conspiracy theories? Should the Senate have this information before we deliberate on the articles of impeachment?
Mr. Chief Justice, Senators, I think there are three categories of relevant material here. The first you do have access to, and that is the supplemental testimony of Jennifer Williams. And I would encourage you all to read it. I think it sheds light very specifically on the Vice President and what he may or may not know vis-a-vis this scheme. So I would encourage you to read that submission. There is a second body of intelligence that the committees have been provided that is relevant to this trial that you should also read. And we should figure out the mechanism that would permit you to do so, because it is directly relevant to the issues we are discussing and pertinent. There is a third category of intelligence, too, which raises a very different problem, and that is that the intelligence communities are for the first time refusing to provide to the intelligence committee. And that material has been gathered. We know that it exists. But the NSA has been advised not to provide it. Now, the director says that this is the director's decision, but nonetheless, there is a body of intelligence that is relevant to requests that we have made that is not being provided. And that raises a very different concern than the one before this body, and that is, are now other agencies like the intelligence community that we require to speak truth to power, that we require to provide us the best intelligence, now also withholding information at the urging of the administration. And that is, I think, a deeply concerning and new phenomenon. That problem we've obviously had with other departments that have been part of the wholesale obstruction, but it now is rearing its ugly head with respect to the IC. But the shorter answer to the question on, apart from Jennifer Williams, are there other relevant materials? The answer is yes. And I would encourage that you and we work together to find out how you might access them.
Thank you, Mr. Manager. Mr. Majority Leader.
Mr. Chief Justice, the next two questions, one from each side, will be the last before we break for dinner. I would ask that following the next two questions, the Senate stand in recess for 45 minutes.
Thank you. Senator from Alabama.
I send a question to the desk.
That'll be a question from Richard Shelby. Okay, so if you want to discuss this, we're going to have a good 45 minutes that we can.
Question is directed to counsel for the president. How does the non-criminal abuse of power standard advanced by the House managers differ from maladministration, an impeachment standard rejected by the framers? Where is the line between such an abuse of power and a policy disagreement?
Well, Shelby must not be paying attention because Jerry Nadler just answered that, and here comes Alan Dershowitz.
Thank you very much for that question, because that question, I think, hits the key to the issue that's before you today. When the framers rejected maladministration...
I just have to wonder if Alan Dershowitz objects to liberals and blacks trying Donald Trump in the Senate. You know, like he did with the trial of Nixon's henchmen back in 1974. I think it's a fair question. Wouldn't it be funny? Wouldn't it be delightful if someone would ask Alan Dershowitz that from the Democratic side? Sir, in 1974, you said you objected to blacks and liberals trying Nixon's henchmen in D.C. Do you also object to the blacks and liberals in this body trying Donald Trump in this proceeding? Wouldn't you just pay money to watch him turn purple at that?
Even Professor Nicholas Bowie, a Harvard professor who was in favor of impeachment, so this is an admission against interest by him. He's in favor of impeachment. He says abuse...
There's no such thing as an admission against interest. There are, in the rules of evidence, statements against interest, but not an admission. That's a bullshit term that's often made by people who are convinced of their own genius.
...century, which is much closer in time to when the framers wrote, Dean Dwight of the Columbia Law School wrote that the weight of authority, by which he meant the weight of scholarly authority and the weight of judicial authority, this is 1867, the weight of authority is in favor of requiring a crime. Justice Curtis came to the same conclusion. Others have come to a similar conclusion. You asked what happened between 1998 and the current to change my mind. What happened between the 19th century and the 20th century to change the mind of so many scholars? Let me tell you what happened. What happened is that the current president was impeached. If, in fact, President Obama or President Hillary Clinton had been impeached, the weight of current scholarship would be clearly in favor of my position, because these scholars do not pass the shoe on the other foot test. These scholars are influenced by their own bias, by their own politics, and their views should be taken with that in mind. They simply do not give objective assessments of the constitutional history. Professor Tribe suddenly had a revelation himself. At the time when Clinton was impeached, he said, oh, the law is clear. You cannot charge a president with a crime while he's the sitting president. Now we have a current president. Professor Tribe got woke. And with no apparent new research, he came to the conclusion, oh, but this president can be charged while sitting in office. That's not the kind of scholarship that should influence your decision. You can make your own decisions. Go back and read the debates, and you will see that I am right that the framers rejected vague, open-ended criteria, abuse of power. And what we had is the manager made a fundamental mistake again. She gave reasons why we have impeachment. Yes, we feared abuse of power. Yes, we feared criteria like maladministration. That was part of the reason. We feared incapacity. But none of those made it into the criteria because the framers had to strike a balance. Here are the reasons we need impeachment. Yes. Now, here are the reasons we fear giving Congress too much power. So we strike a balance. How did they strike it?
What happened that's different? Steve in New York asks. The check cleared. That's what happened.
His crimes and misdemeanors akin to treason and bribery. That's what the framers intended. They didn't intend to give Congress a license to decide who to impeach and who not to impeach on partisan grounds. I read you the list of 40 American presidents who have been accused of abuse of power. Should every one of them be impeached? Should every one of them have been removed from office? It's too vague a term. Reject my argument about crime. Reject it if you choose to. Do not reject my argument that abuse of power would destroy the impeachment criteria of the Constitution and turn it, in the words of one of the senators of the Johnson trial, to make every president, every member of the Senate, every member of Congress be able to define itself from within their own bosom. We heard from the other side that every senator should decide whether you need proof beyond a reasonable doubt or proof by a preponderance. Now we hear that every senator should
thank
decide
you, counsel.
What abuse of power. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Chief Justice.
President, Mr. Chief Justice.
Senator from Maryland.
Chief Justice, I have a question on behalf of Senator Markey and myself that I send to the desk for the House managers.
That would have been Ben Cardin of Maryland. And after this, they're taking a 45-minute dinner and potty break.
The question is as follows. Supreme Court Justice Byron White, in a concurring opinion in Nixon versus United States, 1993, acknowledged that the Senate, quote, has very wide discretion in specifying impeachment trial procedures, end quote, but stated that the Senate, quote, would abuse its discretion, end quote, if it were to, quote, insist on a procedure that could not be deemed a trial by reasonable judges, end quote. If the Senate does not allow for additional evidence and the testimony of key witnesses with firsthand knowledge of President Trump's actions and intentions, would a reasonable judge conclude these proceedings constitute a constitutionally fair trial?
I think the answer is yes. I don't know that we need to look to the words of a prior justice to tell us that a trial without witnesses is not really a trial. It's certainly not a fair trial if the House moves forward with impeachment and comes before the Senate and wants to call witnesses and wants to make its case and is told, thou shalt not call witnesses. That's not a fair trial. I think that the American people understand that without reading the case law. They go to jury.
Fair or unfair, it's not just that that's not a fair trial. That's not a trial at all.
First thing that takes place after the jury is sworn in is the government makes its opening statement, the defense makes theirs, and then begins the calling of witnesses. I do want to take this opportunity, though, to respond to Professor Dershowitz's argument while they're fresh. You can say a lot of things about Alan Dershowitz. You cannot say he's unprepared. He's not unprepared today. He wasn't unprepared 21 years ago. And to believe that he would not have read 21 years ago what Mason had to say or Madison had to say or Hamilton had to say, I'm sorry, I don't buy that. I think 21 years ago he understood that maladministration was rejected. But so was a provision that confined the impeachable offenses to treason and bribery alone was rejected. I think the Alan Dershowitz from 21 years ago understood that, yes, while you can't impeach for a policy difference, you can impeach a president for abuse of power. That's what he said 21 years ago. Nothing has changed since then. I don't think you can write off the consensus of constitutional opinion by saying they're all never Trumpers. All the constitutional law professors, in fact, let's play a snippet from Professor Turley, who was in the House defending the president and see what he had to say recently.
On abuse of power, in my view, it's clear. You can impeach a president for abuse of power. You can impeach a president for non-criminal conduct.
Okay, now, we can't argue plausibly that his position is owing to some political bias, right? I mean, just a few weeks ago, he was in the House arguing the case for my GOP colleagues that the president shouldn't be impeached. Now, he did say, well, if you could actually prove these things, and you could prove, as indeed we have, that the president abused his power by conditioning military aid to help his reelection campaign, yes, that is an abuse of power. You can impeach for that kind of abuse of power. And that's exactly what we have here. We're not required to leave our common sense at the door. If we're to interpret the Constitution now as saying that a president can abuse their power, and I think the professor suggested before the break that he can abuse his power in a corrupt way to help his reelection, and you can't do anything about it. You can't do anything about it. Because if he views it as in his personal interest, that's just fine. He's allowed to do it. None of the founders would have accepted that kind of reasoning. In fact, the idea that the core offense that the founders protected against, that core offense is abuse of power, is beyond the reach of Congress through impeachment, would have terrified the founders. I mean, you can imagine any number of abuses of power. A president who withholds aid from another country at war as a thank you for that adversary allowing him to build a Trump Tower in that country. Okay, that may not be criminal, but are we really going to say that we're going to have to permit a president of the United States to withhold military aid as a thank you for a business proposition? Now, counsel acknowledges that a crime is not necessary, but something akin to a crime. Well, we think there's a crime here of bribery or extortion, conditioning official acts for personal favors. That is bribery. It's also what the founders understood as extortion. And you cannot argue, even if you argue, well, under the modern definition of bribery, you've got to show such and such. You cannot plausibly argue that it's not akin to bribery. It is bribery, but it's certainly akin to bribery. But that's the import of what they would argue, that no, the president has a constitutional right. Under Article 2, he can do anything he wants. He can abuse his office and do so sacrificing our national security, undermining the integrity of the elections, and there's nothing Congress can do about it.
Thank you, Mr. Manager. We're in recess.
Yes, yes, they've all gone to recess now, and they're going to swap moon pies for Twinkies out on the playground. Mm-hmm. We are halfway through the program, and again, we've got $180 to go to finish the fundraising goal for this evening and stay on track. Again, thanks to everyone who jumped in to help meet John's challenge. Thank you very kindly, and thanks to John. So in the remaining hour and a half, well, we got 45 minutes now. If we want to go back to the proceedings when they return, we got 45 minutes to carry on and conversate and whatnot. And let's see what's on Tracy's mind. Hey, Tracy.
Hey, Bob. How the hell are you?
I feel like dirt, but apart from that, you know, it's a great day to be a West Virginian.
Well, why are you feeling? Are you sick? Or are you,
yes.
What's going
yes,
on with
yes,
you?
Yes, yes, I'm sick.
Okay.
Sore throat.
So what's ailing you? Yeah. Is it your stomach? Is it your nose?
Nah, what's happening? Yeah, it's upper respiratory, runny nose, sore throat, sneezing, headache like the top of my skull about to come off. It's a real party.
Oh! Is it the flu or are you just a cold?
I hope the hell not.
Or do you not know?
I don't know.
I hope it's just a cold. Please, God, don't let it be the flu.
Well, I got my flu shot, but who knows?
Yeah, well, shit. I got my flu shot last year, too, and it started off as a cold, went to the flu, and wound up with pneumonia. So let's pray to God that that's not what the year before last, because we are now in 2020. So, yeah, that part. So, yeah.
I got back to West Virginia, and the next morning, Monday morning, I felt like crap. And I've
it's
been,
because you went, you're back in West Virginia.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the air here is damn near toxic. I mean, this reminds me of like what would happen to me when I go down into the Coal River Valley. If I'm down there for the better part of the day, I'll feel like shit for the next 24 hours when I get back up out of it.
Mom used to say, "You have conkus of the bonkus."
Yeah, I'd say, and some kick-ass chicken soup would be nice. But I was just telling Agnes, I think after maybe the program's over, I'm gonna sneak across the river and slurp down a hot bowl of ramen and see if maybe that helps.
Yes, with some kimchi and all that good shit.
Yeah, the spicy ramen.
Yes, yes, that'll do it. You should all that good stuff and some kimchi and some spices and. That'll probably, hopefully it'll kill whatever bug is inside of you. So, yeah, I mean, it's been, as you guys know, it's been a hell of a week for us here in L.A. And by the way, my condolences to Scott. I was listening to the show off and on. I've been, a crazy grief. I have been so grief-stricken. I mean, as you know, what happened to Kobe and his daughter and the other seven people on the helicopter on Sunday. I didn't expect that it was going to hit me so hard. I mean, I have been literally crying since Sunday. And the worst part is I drive past, not the actual crash site, but I drive past, Calabasas every day on my way to pick up Penny. And so to know that up in those hills that this man lost his life and all those other people. And I don't know, I think I texted when I was texting you about why it affected me so badly, besides the fact, this man lost his life. I think it's because children were on that helicopter as well. And it's just, I mean, like I said, I have been crying since Sunday. And I don't, I cannot even wrap my head around the grief that I am feeling and, watching the interviews and, I'm pretty sure you guys have been seeing stuff as well, but, we're at ground zero here in LA and just, the people here have just been, it's just Bob. You could. It's palpable. You could palpable. I can't say the word. You can feel it. I mean, and people. It's like there's a malaise of how people have been just walking around, just like somebody. I can't even explain to you how people have been reacting to this to Kobe's death. I can't even explain it to you, but I think people have just been so sad for the last 3 years, with the bullshit and the crazy that's been going on that, that this death has sudden and violent as it was. I think that just gave people, it was just finally the straw that broke a lot of people's back and said, oh my God, this is it. I can't take anything else. And just people, I think it just broke a lot of people. What do you think?
I don't know. I remember a long time ago when we started having children, my father looked at me and said, well, bub, your life is over. Their lives are what matters.
Yeah, exactly.
And everything you do has to be focused on them and their well-being. And so I tend to think more about the young people who were aboard that aircraft.
Me too. That's what I was saying. It's just,
and the waste of it. And I can't help being who I am. So it's, and I think about issues of privilege and wealth a lot. And
of course we do.
And so, you know, and forgive me for saying this, okay? Why didn't he just drive? Yeah, you're Kobe fucking Bryant. You could spend enough money to gag a horse every day of your life, and never really tap into your wealth.
Ever.
You're Kobe Bryant.
Because
they will wait for you because you're Kobe Bryant. Call the limo company. You got nine people? Cool. Call two limos. Maybe you got two limos sitting in the driveway. Drive over the mountain.
He could have. Right? I mean, especially because he flew, you know, when they flew from Orange County, they flew from Orange County to Burbank. And from Burbank, at that point, they got the special clearance to fly from Burbank to Camarillo or whatever, and that's where, when they flew from Burbank to Camarillo, you know, when they were flying, that's where the trouble started once they got into Calabasas.
Didn't the L.A. Sheriff's Department ground their choppers in that weather? Didn't I read that?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
If the cops won't fly, you don't fly, unless you're fucking El Chapo, right?
Pretty much.
So, I mean,
I recognize
the sense of loss. I mean, I was raised, this is going to sound crazy, growing up in Alabama, but son of a parents from West Virginia, I was raised a Lakers fan, okay? Now, the nearest team was the Atlanta Hawks, I guess, at some point. But I was raised a Lakers fan because of Jerry West. And
yeah. Where's Jerry West from?
About 30 miles from here.
Well, I did not know that. Really?
Yeah, Zeke from Cabin Creek. He hated that nickname, by the way.
so he's a West Virginia boy?
Yeah, yeah. And
did not know that.
Yeah, the Lakers started out in Minneapolis. You know, Minnesota.
That's why they were
Lakers.
Because that's why they were Lakers.
They came from Lake Country.
See, I knew that. Aren't you proud of me?
I am.
Aren't you proud of me that I knew that because of, you know, Minnesota and Atlanta, all those lakes.
So I followed the Lakers all the way through, you know, Jerry West, Gail Goodrich, up into the Magic era. You know, watch
Showtime.
Yeah, and you know the way that Magic and Bird between them saved the NBA. And it has some relevance to me, but I'm just having a hard damn time not being angry with the level of privilege, the level of wealth privilege that attends a decision that says I'm going to cram nine human beings into a helicopter and fly in bad weather. Maybe it marks me out as an asshole, but that seems like...
No, because remember, you and I share the same brain. Remember that part. Because, you know, the science of, you know, well, the stages agree. And me being a Southern Californian, and me being that kind of person, I was pissed as well because I'm like, especially.
I mean, you were driving that day. You were driving in that same basic area that day.
I was, as a matter of fact, I was, and so that time in the morning on a Sunday.
You're alive.
Thank you. That time in the morning on a Sunday, coming from OC to. Thousand to TO, they wouldn't have put any traffic on a Sunday. They would not have. Going back, it would have been a whole different thing. Because I was up and doing stuff
you know
that
what?
Sunday morning.
Yeah, right,
I was
but coming back, you cut by then the weather's cleared. You call the you call the pilot.
That's,
you say
that's when you call for the chopper.
Yeah, you
come and get my ass.
Yeah, buzz on over here and yeah, right. And
but that time in the morning, because they could have made it. They could have made it from the OC to Thousand Oaks. You know, because the game probably started whatever time the game started. If they had left. Because he went to Mass at 7 o'clock, before 7, because 7 a.m. Mass. So he could, if they had left us, you know, the game, I think, whatever time the game started, if they had left at 6:30, and if even if they had left at 7 o'clock Sunday morning, they would have made it to Thousand Oaks. Because, like, from my house to Thousand Oaks, because here's the crazy part, where Mamba Academy, I was, because I'm training, I'm doing the great race out in Nagora at the end of March, and I was offered a discount to train, to do a training at for the next few weeks before that race, and I was offered a discount at the academy, but my schedule didn't permit for that. But seriously, from my house to where the academy is, it's about a 20 to 30 minute drive. You know, in the morning. And so from where he lived, so it was about an hour and a half on a Sunday with no traffic. If, you know, maybe hour and a half to 2 hours. So they could have left at 6, 7 o'clock. They could have left at 7 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday and made it out here with no issue. None. And then, and that's driving with, if you're not in the carpool lane. So there's, you know, because from there to, from Orange County, from the OC to all the way to the 405, that's straight carpool until you get to the 101. So you have straight carpool and no traffic.
I think one of the things that one of the most relevant statements that I saw in the wake of all of this, you know, people who knew him personally had their own recollections their grief, but probably the most, in a way, relevant and heartbreaking statements came from Stephen Colbert. I don't know if you saw this.
No, I didn't.
When Stephen Colbert was a 10-year-old boy, his daddy and some family went up in a private aircraft, and as they were getting ready to land, Stephen Colbert wasn't on the plane. When they were getting ready to land, the crew was having some chit-chat in the front seat up in the cockpit and accidentally plowed the airplane into the ground and killed everybody on board. That was Stephen Colbert's daddy. And I think maybe a brother of his. And a brother of his. And it led to what's called the sterile cockpit rule, wherein flight crews are not allowed to talk about anything but what is going on in the moment relative to the flight at takeoff and landing.
No shit.
Yeah. And you know, Stephen Colbert said essentially that he was immediately, you know, transported when he heard that news. And without fail, once the NTSB is done, I suspect they're not going to find out that, you know, the front fell off or a part of the aircraft failed. It will be blamed on pilot error.
Error, yeah.
Because probably most small aircraft crashes are. And, you know, the last message was climbing to, what, 2,500 feet or something, because he was trying to get out of the fog, and then nothing else.
Nothing else.
Because helicopters are flown VFR, visual flight rules, and the waiver that the pilot got was for SVFR, either special or supplemental visual flight rules. And that's, that's sort of fly at your own risk.
Yeah, so once they got to out here to Burbank, because they're in, effectively, once they got to Burbank, they're in the valley. And so from Burbank to Thousand Oaks, you're talking, like I said, that time, I don't know what time, how long, well, I don't know what time they got to Burbank. You're still talking maybe 30, 40 minutes off to the, you know, 134 to the 101 or whatever, to Thousand Oaks, again. So, like I said, because I'm, what do I do for a living? I drive. And so I'm doing the time it's going to take to get from, Orange County to basically Newport Beach to, driving from Newport Beach on a Sunday morning. Because, like I said, I was on Saturday, I do a lot of driving. That's what I do. And so, I know how basically, because in LA, there's traffic 24/7. And so,
sure.
Like right now, I'm driving in these traffic, but there's even on a Saturday or a Sunday, but there's this certain times of the morning, especially Sunday morning, where there's not going to be any traffic unless there's an accident. So, I knew, like I said, like that time of the morning, there wasn't going to be any traffic. Was not. Because like I said, Sunday, I was up and I was doing stuff on Sunday morning. And like I said, I was driving. Jed and I had done, I didn't go to the gym, but I'd done my workout that morning. A friend of ours had back surgery. So, Jan had made split pea soup the night before. So we were taking split pea soup over there to their house, and we had stopped at the deli and gotten pastrami and that's when on our way there, that's when we found out, first, again, we thought it was, a hoax. And of course, the rush to be first, first we heard that it was Kobe and all four of his daughters. It was just, the TMZ is, they're such garbage. They reported that it was all of his daughters. It was just so horrible. And,
They're ghouls.
They're ghouls. And once, the way, my emotions were going up and down. And then, when it was finally confirmed that it was his daughter,
started out saying it was five people, then it goes up to nine. Yeah. By the way, with fixed wing aircraft, Tracy, Brother Deacon Asa reminds me, sterile cockpit applies at any moment the aircraft is at 10,000 feet or below, either going up or coming down. The same does not apply to helicopters because obviously they don't fly to the heights that fixed wing aircraft do. But that Sikorsky helicopter was the same identical helicopter that Trump flew back when he was running the Trump shuttle helicopter business, and of course it failed.
Miserably, like everything he touches.
Yeah. And they have their uses, but no. No helicopters for me. I remember us being at a protest once down the Coal River Valley and being surveilled by Don Blankenship hovering over us in his Massey Coal Company helicopter.
Isn't that wonderful?
But there's as many things that can go wrong and bring you out of the air in a fixed wing aircraft, because the wings on a helicopter, because those rotors are wings, more things can go wrong. I had a note from Darlene in Connecticut saying, I read that Kobe Bryant began using a helicopter because he was stuck in traffic so much after practices and home games that he felt he was missing time with his daughters. As his wife was with them more and he was traveling a lot, he decided that choppering to and from practices allowed him to arrive in time to pick up his daughters from school. He insisted to his wife. He insisted to his wife that he wanted to pick them up from school because any time he could be with them, even if it was in the car, was worth it. But the only way he could do it was if he took a 15-minute chopper ride to and from home versus sitting in L.A. traffic for 2 hours. That's how he developed a preference for flying in helicopters. Don't forget.
That's what he did.
Yeah, and Darlene continues, don't forget that there is the whole TAWS system that the NTSB recommended and the FAA gave the big fuck you to. Too much regulation? Although it's too early to tell if that device was required to be installed on all choppers, maybe, just maybe, those three 13-year-old girls and adults and goat Kobe Bryant might be alive today. You think there might be some congressional hearings and questions about that?
That part.
Well, congressional hearings and questions, unfortunately, will come to nothing because of the nature of this 116th Congress. You know, Nitwit Nero blabbers on and on about the do-nothing Democrats. But the fact of the matter is, apparently, and you know, it wouldn't surprise me to find out that he's so goddamn stupid he doesn't know that there's over 400 bills sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk waiting for action. So if anybody's a do-nothing, it's Moscow Mitch.
It's Moscow Mitch. But it's, like I said,
I've had a correction. Rick just wrote in and said, helicopters can fly IFR, instrument flight rules, if they're equipped and the pilot is IFR rated. I flew on helicopters for 11 years.
Let's see, I was just, so yesterday, I mean, I was just, you know, the slightest thing just set me into tears. I mean, you know, watching Deer basketball, and I mean, like I said, and I, you know, and I just might start crying again. But so yesterday, you know, I'm doing my physical therapy and all that. So I did my physical therapy yesterday morning, because that's at 7 a.m, you know, before I pick up, do my school run and all that. And I had checked my email before, but I hadn't checked it all. And so I checked my email again on my way to do my school run, and I see an email from CISA. Now, I don't know, I mean, you knew because I told you, but I don't know if I told the rest of the Horn family that back in October, November, I decided to apply to college. And CSUN was the only school that I decided to apply to, because that's it, because it's close to home and I don't need any reason, you know, I don't want to commute anywhere, because again, LA traffic, CSUN is one of those, is in the valley. I don't, even if my car breaks down, I can catch the bus, you know, there's, it'll just be easy for me to get to school. So, you know, like I said, as this past few days, I have been a hot mess. So I see this email from CISA. Now, I wasn't expecting anything because, you know, I was told that you don't hear from CISA or any of the schools until like March to April or whatever about acceptances. So I didn't expect anything. So I opened up the email, and lo and behold, it's my college acceptance letter.
Awesome.
And it was basically, I have been accepted to the fall 2020 class at CSUN, and it's Africana Studies. And it just went to see that, especially being how badly I have been feeling for the last few days because of Kobe and because of just the last fucking 3 years. I have been so profoundly sad, and I, like I said, I didn't realize just how much I've been hurting until what happened on Sunday, and just, it was just everything. And like I said, I have been weeping.
And so that event becomes an avatar of sorts for an overarching sense of grief and loss.
Yes.
The crash of that helicopter carries the freight of a lot of other stuff that was going on in your psyche.
A lot of other stuff. But when I opened up that email and read, you know, congratulations, Tracy. And, you know, and basically the crux of the letter
was like, you know, because of, you know, because I sent you the screenshot. Do you still have? Because I'm driving. Do you still have a screenshot of the letter that I sent you, of my acceptance letter?
It's down here, but it would require some digging.
Oh, never mind. Because of course I can't read and drive. I could, but you know, I don't want to run into anybody. But it just,
well, apparently from the emails I got last night, you're more at risk of having a couch thrown into the middle of the highway at you than I was, even in Kentucky, where there was a couch thrown into the middle of the highway.
Yeah, what was that all about?
I have been duly lectured by Lauren out in the far frozen Canadian mountains. I take her advice seriously. Let me find it here. Let me preach upon you, even though not quite Wednesday talking. Talking on your cell phone while driving is as dangerous hands-free as it is holding onto the stupid thing. People who talk on the phone while driving insist they're better at it than anyone else, that their eyes never leave the road. However, science, i.e. cameras that watch the talkers as they drive, prove that eye movements are completely different in a not good way when you're talking to someone who isn't in the car. I don't know why it's legal to talk on the phone while driving. I guess no one's figured out how to stop people who do that. As a doctor, I managed to practice before there were cell phones, so I can't imagine that there's ever anything that needs to be talked about on the phone while driving. Maybe you would have seen the Chesterfield a few seconds earlier had you not been on the phone with Agnes. I'm glad you saw it in time. Well, I saw it earlier. The problem is, I didn't know what the hell it was. My brain was processing and going, is that a shadow? Is that a piece of cardboard? Fuck, it's a couch!
Oh, my God. I've outmaneuvered things being, you know, in the highway on many occasions. But then again, I have been driving for a living for so many years that, I spend more time on the road than the average motherfucker, so anywho. But I just emailed you. I just forwarded you my acceptance letter. So if you don't mind, because I think reading that might kind of bring a little bit of joy.
Yeah, and, I got it here.
You know, okay.
Dear Tracy, dated 28 January 2020. Congratulations, it is my pleasure to offer you admission to California State University Northridge CSUN for the fall 2020 semester. Your academic record reflects a commitment to excellence that will serve you well here at CSUN. Welcome to the Matador family. You will receive an admission packet by mail with lots of details. In the meantime, let's take care of business. And they want your transcripts, they want your intent to register, and once again, congratulations on your admission to CSUN. Go Matadors. So you're going to be a Matador.
I'm going to be a Matador. So you know I ugly cried. Because, like I said, I ugly cried when I opened that. Because I had just, you know, because when I was listening to the radio, somebody was, you know, talking about Kobe. And I had just finished ugly crying about that. And I opened that email and read that. And then I called my therapist. And, you know, because y'all have known my life for the past, how many years have we known each other at this point, Bob?
North of 10.
And you know my life and the trials and the tribulations that I have, you know, that I have gone through. And I burst into tears because, and especially just in the last 7 months of, you know, with my weight loss and, you know, the 5Ks and now training for a triathlon and getting over my fear of swimming and riding a bike and all these things and realizing that I am so much more, I am capable of so much more than I ever thought I was capable of. And to get into college.
All you had to do was dare to try.
I dared to try.
That's
beautiful. That's beautiful. Well, you got a note from Darlene in Connecticut. Congratulations, sorority sisters. So proud of you. And Flavio says, congratulations, Tracy Matadora. It's Matadora. Feminine. Yeah.
Okay. That's right. For the feminine. That's right. Matadora. I mean,
And then Jack in Shreveport, of course. Jack's mind works a little different from the rest of ours. Or not the rest of ours, because there's others, probably others thought this too. If one member of the community thinks it, somebody else has got it going on. Matador? Like the car? I couldn't resist. LOL. Yeah. The AMC Matador, because, you know, not far away is Cal State University, Rancho Cucamonga, and they're the Gremlins. Gremlins, Matadors.
Oh, Jesus.
Somewhere.
And Matadors. Right.
Yeah, and you know, that's one of the reasons I worry about that missile system that we've sent to Ukraine, because it's the Javelin. And, well. You know,
oh, Jesus.
That's another AMC you know, product.
Wasn't that Mitt Romney's dad?
Yes, oh, yes. Yes, it was.
You know, the things. See, here's the thing about why I love this show. And this station, this community, I have learned so much in the last 10 years, almost 10 years of listening to the show and being a part of the community. It has broadened my horizons, and, you know, I've learned more stuff about politics than I would have ever have learned on my own. I learned in school, and, you know, just the fact that now I'm going to take what I've learned so far, and I'm going to take that to, you know, CSUN. And I am excited. It was so funny because when I graduated from high school back in, you know, 1984, and I got it because I went to San Francisco State. That's where I graduated. When I graduated from high school, that's where I graduated and got accepted to. I don't even remember how I felt when I graduated from high school and I got accepted to San Francisco State. But when I opened up that email and read that acceptance letter box, the joy that I felt yesterday, I don't remember the last time I don't remember the last time I felt that kind of joy, you know, other than when I married Jan and when I had Alex. I don't remember the last time I felt that kind of joy. It was unbridled. I mean, but like I said, it was this crazy mixture of the joy and then, like I said, and the grief that I was still feeling over, you know, it was just crazy. I don't even know what those emotions were. It was just this crazy, like I said, and you know, even with all of that, I'm still sad. I am still crazy sad, but it's tempered now.
There's a little bit of balance to it. Yeah.
There's some balance
well,
to it.
Lee in New York says, congratulations, Tracy. You never know what you'll get out of college. I met my wife there. I did not expect that.
Randy, I met my wife already.
Well, with you being a Matadora, Randy in PA says, as opposed to my college experience, which was sort of full of bull.
See what he did there? See
yeah,
what
little,
he did
little,
there?
Little, cow, little cowbell for Randy. Meanwhile, talking about crap on the road, Visage 17, Rusty says, I once ran over a surfboard that had fallen off of a Chevy 2 station wagon on the way to Santa Cruz, California. Yikes, it wasn't pretty. All five axles.
Ooh. Yeah, I ran, when I first started driving cab years ago, somebody dropped something fell off somebody's truck, and I ran over. I forget what it was. I don't even know what it was that I ran over, but whatever it was, it punctured my reserve for my air conditioning, and all the air conditioning fluid leaked out. I've had stuff punctured, and my brake fluid has leaked out. It's just crazy shit. But I have
I saw once, now I have seen shit when people have ran into stuff. I saw once this woman, trash can fell off of a car, truck, gardener's truck. And it fell off, the trash can fell off the truck. She was in a Volkswagen. She swerved to try to miss it. She did miss it, but somehow she lost control of her car and she 360 and then the car rolled. And I'm sitting there watching this shit. I'm like, oh, wow. I mean, it's so crazy what can happen when stuff falls off of vehicles and then the vehicle just keeps going. Because a lot of times they don't even realize shit fell off their car or their truck. And they've caused a massive accident and they're just going on about their business, you know? But, you know, I'm glad, you know, you're okay and all that. So speaking of cars, Sunday was our first day, my first time riding in the new Subaru, you know, the official car of lesbian and hipsters.
And hipster lesbians.
And hipster lesbians. Because I'm not a hipster, far from it, but I definitely am a lesbian. And that, oh my God, the car's so nice. Oh my God. It has the lane assist and the collision avoidance and the blind spot thingy and the backwards, the rear backup thingy and all sorts of stuff. And it has the sunroof and the sports, the real nice sports rack on top for, you know, my bike and all sorts of stuff. It's a really, ask me, have I driven it yet?
Have you driven it yet?
No.
Is this a don't wanna or Jan won't let you?
No. Actually, I just haven't had the chance to because she just got a Friday and I've been working. And so, no, it's not that I don't want to. I just haven't had a chance to. So, you know, no, I'll drive it eventually. I just haven't had the chance to. But here's the good news. Jan is making a serious effort not to smoke in the car.
Well, good for her.
She's really making an effort not to smoke in the car. She won't even take her. She's making such an effort that she is leaving her. She's not even taking the cigarettes with her when she drives the car.
Wow.
She doesn't even want to be tempted. Because it's not like, you know, basically when she goes anywhere, because, you know, Jam works from home. So it's not like she has a commute or anything. Like today, did she go anywhere today? No, but yesterday she had a doctor's appointment. And, you know, there and back. She went to the store the other day. So she doesn't have the first longest she's ever really in the car is, maybe half an hour or so, you know, for now. But like I said, she's really trying not to smoke in the car. So I'm very, because I don't smoke.
Right.
And, you know, did I tell you how much I hate cigarette smoke?
A lot.
A lot. And even though she smokes outside, it doesn't matter because the smoke still comes in the house. I mean, I smell it still comes in the house, and my clothes smell like cigarette smoke. You know, you smokers, you know, damn you people. You know, I love you, but I fucking hate cigarette smoke. And like I keep telling her, I'm going to be the one
well,
that
hey,
fucking
I'm
dies.
The, I'm,
you
the
know.
Little, I'm the little ray of sunshine. It could be worse. It could be cigar smoke.
Fuck you.
Very much. Yes.
It's like, you know, I am completely convinced that I'm going to be the one that will die of lung cancer because of secondhand smoke.
Because that's just the way, because that's my life. You know, I will finally lose 100 pounds and be, you know, with this fabulous fucking body and all that. And I will be the one that, you know, then I will have fucking lung cancer and die of lung cancer. And I will come back and haunt her ass because I'm like, really, bitch? Really? I get lung cancer?
Hey, Tracy. Ugh. Precious Lindsay has found a camera to talk to. Let's check in real quick, okay?
Oh, wow. Yes,
see, we found out today that Precious Lindsay was brought inside the loop by Rudy Giuliani to do some of this dirty business.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I did. Ooh. For real, though?
Yeah, let's see what's going on here.
You know for sure, because if there's going to be one witness, there'll be more. There's 53 Republican votes to call Hunter Biden, not 51, not 52, because all of us believe this trial goes on. Hunter Biden is a very relevant witness in terms of whether or not the president had a reason to believe that there was corruption in the Ukraine.
Hunter Biden. He draws Hunter Biden like a gun. Here's the fun thing. I wonder when we're going to get real good about it and say, hey, When's Trump going to come testify? Because I'd kind of like to know that. Another thing, we've gotten it down to $170 this evening. Thank you, Todd. Thank you very, very kindly for jumping in. I'm much obliged, and hopefully we'll knock out at least a little bit more of that this evening. That would be very helpful. And I had a note from. Rick said, I'm the new subscriber. I know. I live in Eastern Washington. I had lived in South Carolina, and I hold a BA from Coker College, Hartsville, South Carolina, class of 92. I can relate to Todd. Eastern Washington has their own class of conservatives. Been a listener off and on for the last 3 years. Keep up the good work. Thanks. Thanks, Lee. Thanks so much. Thanks, Rick. Thanks, Rick, so much. I just saw a note come in from Lee. That's why I transposed. Thank you, Rick, so much. Hope you enjoy it, and thanks for being part of the community. Lee, on the other hand, Lee said, I had bronchial asthma as a child. My mother smoked. It killed her at 66. It killed my uncle at 58.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So
I think the only way that Jen is going to stop smoking, because, see, the thing is, and she's actually said it, unless her doctor tells her that she's, you know, has like 10% of her lungs left, that's the only way she's going to stop smoking. I'm like, really, bitch? You have to, like, be dying of lung cancer before you stop smoking? How about this? Why don't you stop smoking because you still have your lung function? Really? You got to, you know, be one of those commercials when you're, you know, you're breathing through a hole in your throat? Ugh!
I know.
I know it's an addiction. Like, I understand this shit. Aren't you that taco truck with those empanadas?
Yes. Yes.
So that's my Bob.
And see that one of the things I found out the little real honest to God taqueria down there in Florence began serving pupusas. Oh yes.
Oh my God, Bob. Oh Jesus, pupusas. They're God's gift, especially. Oh my God. So this taco truck, when you order the empanadas, oh by the way, they're shrimp empanadas.
Ooh.
So they, you know, they don't do the empanada until you order the empanada. So the empanada is the filling is kind of like a ceviche.
Yeah.
So then it's a ceviche, but then.
Oh, and by the way, we were talking about hangover cures earlier. That's another great one. The really, really spicy Peruvian ceviche juice. Yeah, that'll cure what ails you too.
So then they put like the Mexican cheese inside of it there too. And then, you know, lightly fried. Oh, and oh my God, so they do that, and then and also then this is the shrimp taco as well, but and it's like I said, it's a grilled shrimp taco. Bob. So that's been my Monday and Wednesday thing, because I have that after, because I do my swim practice on Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays at noon. So that's been my lunch on Monday, Wednesday. One shrimp taco and one shrimp ciabatta.
Yummy. Randy says, please tell Tracy to eat well while she's at college. Time is tight and good nutrition is brain fuel.
Yes. And you know, plus,
maybe there'll be a nearby taco truck.
Oh, there's all this stuff. I mean, we're talking CSUN, and they have, because I'm they have great stuff everywhere. It's their way, and so they always have some kind of something going on campus. And I cannot believe that I'm actually, I can't explain to you how excited I am, considering that I have been going to school off and on since when I had to, input all my classes, because I had to sit there and when I applied, input every single class that I've ever taken over the last fucking 35 years. Yeah, that shit was fun. So I have effectively taken somewhere in north of at least 200 units of course credit. Now, I don't remember how many units I think the max that I think I will actually get credit for, maybe it's like 90 units. When I make my appointment for my advising or whatever, that's when I find out exactly what I got unit credit for. I think at this point I only have like two lore division classes to take, and that would be a life science and political science. But the great part is the political science that I have to take, because my major is Africana Studies, and that's black studies for y'all. I'm going to study about my folks. Because it's my major, they actually have poli sci on for Africana Studies. Do you know how cool that class is going to be?
There's gonna be some really, really neat stuff in there. Like, among other things, I would guess the post Reconstruction, in post Reconstruction America, when African Americans went to Congress for the first time.
And that
was part of what drove the rebellion against Reconstruction.
Exactly.
In a big way.
And see, hopefully that class will be offered fall 2020. Because you never know, sometimes classes aren't offered. Sometimes they're offered in the fall. Sometimes they're offered in the spring. But I really, 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 really hope that that particular poli sci will be offered fall 2020, because we'll be going into an election November 2020. School starts, I think, some fall 2020. Fall starts in August, so I will be 3 months into the semester by the time the election happens this year. So poli sci this year, taking a poli sci class in an election year, and a Black Studies poli sci class at that will be a fucking amazing. So, I'm just beyond excited about, the fact that I chose a man. That is a European, or I'm not choosing a major that is supposed that would just get me a job, or you know what I'm saying? It's something that I want for me.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, because I know there's so many things that I can do with a, you know, effectively with a black studies major. I could go into, you know, cultural diversity, conflict resolution. My goal is to do something with conflict resolution, cultural sensitivity training, trauma studies, untreated trauma. There's so many things that I can do with a degree in Black studies. Basically, my whole life has been, you know, a degree, this Black, you know, just me being me and what my life experience has been, that I could do a whole lot. The only thing that has stopped me from doing a lot of the things that I've been wanting to do is just the fact that I don't have a few letters behind my name. So that part. So yeah, I'm just, like I said, I think it's just taken me this long to finally finish my degrees, because I've never found anything that ever really spoke to me. And this is speaking to me. So I'm just, again, this is just me being.
Well, I've got high hopes that, and I know the whole community does, that you will just, you'll just park this in the cheap seats. You'll put it out. You'll knock it out of the park. I have no doubt of that whatsoever. Well, it looks like they're back from dinner and potty break. Balls and Strikes has put his blinders back on.
Oh, that motherfucker. You guys, you go ahead and listen to this. I'm going to go home and
Tracy. Drive the car.
I'm parked. No, I am parked. I'm going to go check my mail and I'm going to go home and.
That's what I mean. Today is when you get home, I mean, it's drive the Nubaru, okay? You've got a Nubaru.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to go for a run. I need to do an endurance run, at least a three to four mile run this evening before it gets too dark. So that's what I'm going to do, and ride the bike in preparation for the for the triathlon next month. Crazy me, why in the world do I think I could do a triathlon? Oh yeah, because it's there.
Because I can. But you have to drive the Nubaru. Just get over its get over its essential whiteness. And I mean, at least tell me the interior is black. I mean, come on.
The interior is black. The interior is actually black. Yes,
see,
it is.
It's perfect for your marriage then.
The interior of the car is black. That it is. It is a nice car. I have to say, it really, I am very, very, like I said, maybe I'll drive it this evening because, like I said, I'm going for a run, and maybe I'll drive it up to because there's a running shoe store and they do a Wednesday evening run, and maybe I'll drive it up to the store where the run is. So maybe I'll do that just so I can, get used to.
Well, before you go, I had a note from Lady B, and I'll share the rest of it later.
Oh, I have to do that.
But she said, PP at the end, she said, PPS, Tracy, 3 days later, I'm dealing okay with Kobe's passing, but then again, I'm not in L.A., where you guys must be bombarded with imagery about his legacy. We never expect our heroes to go before their time, and because our heroes are never perfect, prepare for the shitstorm that's already starting. But he brought a lot of incredible talent and energy to the game. He will be missed. Congrats on getting accepted into college. Don't pressure yourself. Take as long as you need, and enjoy the experience. Once received, no one can ever take that knowledge away from you. I've got a master's degree, and I loved going to college. I hope you do, too.
Thank you, Lady B. This is an experience that I am truly, because I haven't been to a quote-unquote real college since I went to San Francisco State. 35 some odd years ago.
So to be on a real, you know, because I've done online, I've done, you know, those, you know, private, you know, colleges where they, you know, you're basically at a, you know, in an office building, you know, so you're not on the real campus. And, you know, so this is an experience that I am really, truly looking forward to. And just, you know what I'm really excited about? You know what I'm really thinking about doing? And I am really considering, because my dream, I've always wanted to be a Delta. That is the one thing, you know, Delta Sigma Theta. I wanted to pledge a sorority back in the day. But the reason why I never pledged is because I have, you know, as quiet as we kept, all black folks, and I have said it 100 times.
There will be step singing. There will be step singing.
And so, you know, I'm hoping that they'll see the old lady, and they won't make me try to step.
No, I don't think you're going to get out. You know, then again, we got to come up with some Greek letters. You just need to colonize your own sorority, you know. Lambda, Rho, Omicron, or Tau, Rho, Tau, Rho, Omicron, Omicron, okay. Tracy's Reverse Oreo.
There you go. Tracy's Reverse Oreo Cookie Society. Well, tell Lady B, thank you for the well wishes. I am coming from you. It just makes this, you know, this my college acceptance even more sweeter. So on that note, I'm gonna boogie. So while I still got daylight, and you know, to my Horn family, thank you. I love you. And like I said, this my college acceptance has made this unbearable last few days, nay, last few months, last 3 years, just a little less, you know.
And take it as a good sign that the good will outweigh the bad in the coming year.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm hoping.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that my college acceptance is just a sign of even better things to come in 2020.
Well, Megan says, congratulations, Tracy. A year ago yesterday, I graduated with a Bachelor's of Science degree in Northern Delaware. There was a 13-year hiatus between when I started at community college and when I finished at a university, but I did it, and I'm glad every day I did.
See? Yay.
Thanks, Megan. And we're glad
you did,
too.
Thank you, Megan. Congratulations on that, Megan. I'm so very proud of you. So, see, the old lady can do it. If everything goes as planned, you know, and thank you, Lady B. No matter how, who knows how long it's going to take, it's going to take as long as it takes. That part.
Exactly. All right, then. So, you have yourself a lovely evening, and we'll get back. We'll get back to Moscow Mitch's impeachment trial sham.
The bullshit and the bullshit keeps going. Good night, y'all.
All right, take care, Tracy. Bye now.
Bye.
Tracy, the lady cab driver, calling from Southern California with wonderful, wonderful news for her future. Back to Lady B's note earlier. Rich kids and coincidence, college and Kobe. So what's Biden been up to all this time? Is he laying low till the storm passes? Don't get me wrong. The last thing anybody needs is for Joe to put his foot in his mouth. And I know rich people's kids get assigned to cushy jobs most of us can't reasonably apply logic to. But that's life. Hunter was probably about as qualified as any other rich, politically connected, Ivy League schooled kid, which is to say, it doesn't matter. He's got a law degree. Maybe he could have been advising them on legal things, like corporate governance, I add. What bothers me, though, is this incredible confluence of things that put all the right motherfuckers in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's like eating your Big Mac next to the guys discussing and then later robbing the cash register. You may not have been in on it. You left before they put their masks on, but you were there. What and how much did you know about it? How did you end up in that place at that time next to these motherfuckers? Coincidence is a hell of a thing. If Hunter doesn't know anything, he doesn't know. He ate his Big Mac and left. But goddammit, rich people's social circles are tiny and specific. For fuck's sake, out of all the places and out of all the human beings to be caught up in this mess, did it have to be a future Democratic presidential candidate's son? Joe Biden cannot be the nominee.
He'll end up fucking it up just like Hillary did. Not because of his qualifications, but because of who his friends and family are. It sucks, but that's life. He knew things could get shady, or at least he should have. Ukraine was corrupt, and Hunter happened to be working for a powerful natural gas company while his father was trying to help the country change a shitty diaper. Unfortunately, his son got a little shit on him. If Biden wins the primary, which I don't think he should or will, he's going to Hillary his way out of the general. People have long and twisted memories. Joe will have to deal with this taint on his reputation for the rest of his life. And there's a lot of, and signed, lady, humbled every day by the most mundane things, B. And there's something that happened, it was yesterday, I think it was, time out, sneeze coming. Oh, wait, we have to go to Val Demings for this. The question, does the conflict of interest standard for Hunter Biden apply to President Trump's children and son-in-law?
Wrongdoing. Thank you.
Yeah, damn, I'd like to have heard that. But they gave the game away when noted hog deballer Joni Ernst admitted yesterday that the Republicans are sitting around waiting to see what impact this has on Joe Biden's campaign relative to the Iowa caucuses. In other words, this is just a shitty little attempt, like Benghazi was, to harm his political fortunes. These are some rat fucking sons of bitches. Question to the Chief Justice.
The question from Senator Crapo and the other senators for the counsel for the president. Does the evidence in the record show that an investigation in the Burisma Biden matter is in the national interest of the United States and its efforts to stop corruption?
Mr. Chief Justice.
Ah, here comes urine-colored necktie Philbin again.
The straightforward answer is yes. The evidence does show that it would be in the interest of the United States. In fact, the evidence on that point is abundant. Here's what we know. Hunter Biden was appointed to the board of an energy company in Ukraine without any apparent experience that would qualify him for that position.
He was appointed shortly after. You filthy fucking liar. He came from a law firm with expertise in corporate governance, and he was hired for that reason. Maybe also because his last name was Biden, but the legitimate reason was corporate governance. Fuck off, you dirty, filthy little liar.
Relationship with Hunter, citing Hunter's lack of judgment in joining the board of that company, Burisma, because Burisma was owned by an oligarch who was repeatedly under investigation for corruption, for money laundering, and other offenses.
And make no mistake, this is not spontaneous. This is planned. This is their big opportunity to turn this. It's it's like a rape trial, okay? It's like one of those filthy little rape trials that Alan Dershowitz used to work, where in fact, where you take a woman who has been brutalized, who has been raped, and instead of defending your rapist client, you put the rape victim on trial. It's the oldest defense trick in the book. Try the victim, not the perp. That's exactly what the hell is going on here.
The Ukrainian natural gas company, Burisma Holdings, which is owned by a former government official suspected of corrupt practices. And it went on. Reports from the Wall Street Journal said that activists here, that is in the Ukraine, say that the U.S.'s anti-corruption message is being undermined as his son receives money from a former Ukrainian official who is being investigated for graft. At the same time, within the Obama administration, officials raised questions. The Special Envoy for Energy Policy, Amos Hochstein, raised the matter with the Vice President. Similarly, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Kent testified that he, too, voiced concerns with Vice President Biden's office. Everyone who was asked in the proceedings before the House of Representatives agreed that there was at least an appearance of a conflict of interest when Mr. Biden's son was appointed to the board of this company. that included Ambassador Yovanovitch, Deputy Assistant Secretary Kent, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, Jennifer Williams, Ambassador Sondland, Dr. Fiona Hill, and Ambassador Taylor. They all agreed there was an appearance of a conflict of interest. And even in the transcript of the July 25th telephone call, President Zelensky himself acknowledged the connection between the Biden and Burisma incident, the firing of the prosecutor who reportedly had been looking into Burisma, when Vice President Biden openly acknowledged he leveraged $1 billion in U.S. loan guarantees to make sure that that particular prosecutor was fired. He openly acknowledged it was an explicit quid pro quo. You don't get $1 billion in loan guarantees.
Wait, what? Nitwit Nero didn't do the quid pro quo, but Joe Biden did? Oh, fuck me to a million pieces. This is... Are they stoned or stupid? The prosecutor he's talking about was as crooked as a dog's hind leg. And that's why he was run out. That's not in dispute with anyone except maggots, because they have the brain power of a run-over goldfish.
That there's not going to be corruption. So that explicit exchange in the July 25th call shows that President Zelensky recognized that Biden-Burisma incident had an impact on corruption and anti-corruption. And so it was definitely undermining the U.S. message on anti-corruption. And it was a perfectly legitimate issue for the president to raise with President Zelensky to make clear that the United States did not condone anything.
Because that implies that the president of the United States at present, Donald J. Trump, knows anything. And the only thing Donald J. Trump knows is about self is about aggrandizing himself.
Senator from Illinois. Thank you.
Oh, by the way, I had a technical question from Ron and Raleigh wanting to know why it was another program comes on when this one buffers up and goes off.
That's Senator Durbin's question is directed to the House managers. Would you please respond to the answer that was just given by the President's counsel?
Anyway, that's the backup, and it comes on whenever I buffer up and go off. That way, there's always a rerun stream going. Brother Deacon Asa took that on himself when I wasn't able to run the rerun stream from here when the streaming computer died.
Mr. Chief Justice, Senators, the president sought Ukraine's help in investigating the Bidens only after reports suggested Vice President Biden might enter the 2020 presidential race and would seriously challenge President Trump in the polls. President Trump had no interest in Biden's Obama-era Ukraine work in 2017 or 2018 when Biden was not running against him for president. None of the 17 witnesses in the impeachment inquiry provided any credible evidence, no credible evidence, to support the allegation that former Vice President Biden acted inappropriately in any way in Ukraine. Instead, witnesses testified that the former Vice President was carrying out official U.S. policy in coordination with the international community when he advocated for the ouster of a corrupt Ukrainian official. In short,
see,
the allegations are simply unfounded. President Trump's own handpicked special envoy to Ukraine Ambassador Kurt Volker knew they were unfounded too. He testified that he confronted the president's attorney, Mr. Giuliani, about this conspiracy theories and told him that, quote, "It is simply not credible to me that Joe Biden would be influenced in his duties as vice president by money or things for his son or anything like that. I've known him for a long time. He's a person of integrity, and that's not credible." Giuliani acknowledged that he did not find one of the sources of these allegations, a former Ukrainian prosecutor, to be credible. So even Giuliani knew the allegations were false.
As Lady B points out, that's my point, darling. Hunter Biden did nothing wrong, but because Dems kept and keep letting Republicans dictate the narrative, this is the shit we got to deal with. It's not right or fair, and it was never supposed to be, but Republicans played dirty. It's only going to get worse. And hence, I wonder, maybe I've missed it where they said it. I think I would have seen a story about it if they had. But it would be nice if one of the House managers, preferably Adam Schiff or Jerry Nadler, No, I take that back. I think Val Demings would probably be the best to handle this, would do exactly what I did a few minutes ago, explain that this, that the Hunter Biden business is exactly the 100% analog to a defense lawyer asking, how was the victim of the rape dressed? Did she want it? Or maybe in the era of Me Too, you can't do that anymore because people would throw a fit and say, no, this is just political corruption. Only rape can be rape and yada, 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 which has an element of truth to it. But the lawyering technique is the same damn thing. Did she get on the pool table willingly? Did she bring the fish to Led Zeppelin's hotel room herself? It's sleazy, it's filthy, it's dishonest, and even in modern criminal defense lawyering, it's deemed nasty and in some cases impermissible. But here are the Republicans doing it any damned way.
To coerce Ukraine to help him attack his political opponent and secure his reelection. Well, the President of the United States cannot use our taxpayer dollars to pressure a foreign government to do his personal bidding. No one is above the law.
Thank you.
Back.
The senator from South Carolina.
Thank you, sir. I sent a question to the desk on behalf of myself, Senators Crapo and Graham, for the White House Counsel.
Question is from Senator Scott to the White House Counsel. House managers claim that the Biden-Burisma affair has been debunked. What agency within the government or independent investigation led to the debunking?
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Senate, there is no evidence in the record about any investigation, let alone debunked, sham, discredited, or as Manager Jeffries told you tonight, phony. The House managers haven't cited any evidence in the record because none exists. A couple of days ago, I read to you a quote and statements from Vice President Biden dealing with corruption in Ukraine. What I didn't tell you was he made those statements before the Ukrainian parliament directly. He spoke about the historic battle of corruption. He spoke about fighting corruption specifically in the energy sector. He spoke about no sweetheart deals. He said oligarchs and non-oligarchs must play by the same rules. Corruption siphons away resources from the people. It blunts economic growth and it affronts the human dignity. Those were Vice President Biden's words. So the real question is this. Is corruption related to the energy sector in Ukraine run by a corrupt Ukrainian oligarch who was paying our vice president's son and his son's business partner millions of dollars.
You know what's chilling here? Because we sit and we listen to these professional liars on the Trump team, and we just say, oh, they're lying. But what's chilling is that every word coming out of this freak's mouth and all the other freaks, long before it became part of the record in this sham of a trial, was a Kremlin talking point pumped out by the Kremlin's propaganda apparatus. That's demonstrable. And the Republicans, whose server also was hacked by the Russians, but the data on which was not released, repeat it, repeat these Kremlin talking points like a fucking minor bird.
State Department to the chief of staff to John Kerry and his special assistant. The subject is Ukraine. There's no question when you look at that email that it's a warning shot to say, I don't know what they're doing, but we're not invested in it. He's taking a giant step back. And think about the words, and remember the video that we saw about Hunter Biden. What did he say? I'm not going to open my kimono. I'm not going to open my kimono when he was asked how much money he was making. In one month alone, Hunter Biden and his partner made almost as much as every senator and congressman, just in 1 month alone what you earn in a year. And you don't think that merits inquiry? Does it?
Well, by God, if it does, then precious princess, I wank him a daddy Trump Kushner and what she's made out of sleazy Chinese deals on her daddy's name. And Beavis and Butthead and they went to Jared deserves equal or more scrutiny. So let's bring those sleazy little grifty gits into the process, too.
See the legal department of a Ukrainian company? He's going to help them. And if you look at his statement that I read to you beforehand, there's another part of it from October of 2019. If you want to know whether he thought it dealt with outside of Ukraine in just the Burisma, he says he was advising Burisma on its corporate reform initiatives, an important aspect of fueling Burisma's international growth and diversity. And listen to this statement by Hunter Biden's attorney. Vibrant energy production, particularly natural gas, was central to Ukraine's independence and to stemming the tide of Vladimir Putin's attack on the principles of a democratic Europe. Do you think he understood when he was getting the millions of dollars what his father was doing? The only problem is that statement didn't come out till October of 2019. Only when the news story started to break, only when the House managers raised these issues, did people start to talk about it. Tell us where we saw Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, John Kerry testify about it. Tell us where you did it when you did your impeachment hearings. I don't remember seeing that testimony. I don't remember seeing...
By the way, John Roberts is not calling this fucker down, even though he's violating the rules. He is not addressing the jury. He is looking directly at the House managers and speaking to them. That ain't supposed to happen, but old balls and strikes up there, well, yeah, he'll just call that a ball.
Thank you.
Next question coming to the dais. I got about 6 minutes left in the program, $170 to go in fundraising. Just thought I'd mention that.
The question from Senator Merkley and other senators is for counsel to the president.
Uh-oh.
Please clarify your previous answer about the Bolton manuscript. When exactly did the first person on the president's defense team first learn of the allegations in the manuscript? Secondly, Mr. Bolton's lawyer publicly disputes that any information in the manuscript could reasonably be considered classified. Was the determination to block its publication on the basis that it contains classified information made solely by career officials or were political appointees in the White House counsel's office or elsewhere in the White House involved.
Well, there ought to be some serious professional-grade harumphing going on, and here comes Urantai.
Mr. Chief Justice, Senator, to address your question specifically, the allegation that came out in the New York Times article about a conversation that is allegedly reported in the manuscript between the President and Ambassador Bolton, officials, lawyers in the White House counsel's office learned about that allegation for the first time on Sunday afternoon when the White House was contacted by the New York Times.
If this little fucker was asked if the sky was blue, he wouldn't admit he was on planet fucking Earth.
Counsel's office is not involved in classification review, determining what's classified or not classified. I can't state the specifics. My understanding is that it's conducted by career officials at the NSC, but it's handled by the NSC, so I'm not in a position to give you full information on that. My understanding is being done by career officials, but it is not being done by lawyers in the White House counsel's office. And I hope that answers your question, Senator.
Run away.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Chief Justice.
Senator from Alaska.
Mr. Chief Justice, I sent a question to the desk on behalf of myself and Senator Langford for the President's counsel.
Thank you.
Oh, that was telling, wasn't it? Naturally, he wouldn't answer the question. Because, you see, Jay Sokolode and Pat Cipollone are up to their eyeballs in an ethical violation.
Question from Senator Sullivan and Langford to the counsel for the president. There has been conflicting testimony about how long the Senate might be tied up in obtaining additional evidence. At the beginning of this trial, the minority leader offered 11 amendments to obtain additional evidence in the form of documents and depositions from several federal agencies. If the Senate had adopted all 11 of these amendments, how long do you think this impeachment trial would take?
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Senate,
Jay Sokolode.
It would take a long time. It would take a long time just to get through those motions. But there have been 17 witnesses. We're talking about now additional witnesses.
Like they had in the Clinton
that
trial.
The managers are put forward and that Democratic leader Schumer has discussed. He's discussed four witnesses in particular as if this body would, if it were to grant witnesses, would say, yes, you get those four witnesses and the White House and the President's counsel gets what? Whatever I want. That's what he said, Mr. Schumer. Whatever I want, here's who I want. I want Adam Schiff. I want Hunter Biden. I want Joe Biden. I want the whistleblower. I want to also understand there may be additional people within the House Intelligence Committee that have had conversations with that whistleblower. I get anybody we want. By the way, if we get anybody we want, we will be here for a very long time. The fact of the matter is, we're not here to argue witnesses tonight, but it obviously is an undercurrent. But to say that this is not going to extend this proceeding, months. Because understand something else. Despite the, you know, executive privilege and other nonsense, I suspect Manager Schiff, smart guy, he's going to say, wait a minute, I got some speech and debate privileges that may be applicable to this. I'm not saying that they are, but they may raise it, be legitimate to raise it. So this is a process that this would be the first of many weeks. I think we've got to be clear.
Gee, I don't know. Is the Constitution of the United States worth the first of many weeks? And once again, nobody's talking about the goddamn defendant testifying. Of course, I guess he's got a Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. But there aren't any criminal, there's no criminal jeopardy that attaches to this. So no, he doesn't.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Yeah, the senator from New Jersey.
And to think that Sokolode, it's prayer meeting Wednesday, to think that Sokolode considers himself a Christian. Jesus is puking. We'll get one more question and then I'll call it quits.
The question is from Senator Menendez to the House managers. President Trump has maintained that he withheld U.S. security assistance to Ukraine because he was concerned about corruption. Yet his purported concern about corruption did not prevent his administration from sending congressionally appropriated assistance to Ukraine more than 45 times between January 2017 and June 2019, totaling more than $1.5 billion. So why did the president suddenly become concerned about corruption in early 2019?
Well, that ought to be a slam dunk. Here comes Jason Crow of Colorado.
Mr. Chief Justice, Senator, thank you for the question. He became concerned about corruption, supposedly, in early 2019 because Vice President Biden was running for election for the presidency. That is what the overwhelming amount of the evidence shows, because there's no other legitimate reason, as your question points out. First, the publicly released records of President Trump's April 21 and 25 calls with President Zelensky never mentioned the word corruption, despite the fact that the talking points for these calls prepared by his own staff listed corruption. Second, in May 2019, the State and Defense Department certified to Congress Ukraine had, quote, taken substantial actions for the purposes of decreasing corruption, end quote, and met the anti-corruption benchmarks this very body has established when it appropriated $250 million of those funds. Third, by the time of the July 25th call, President Zelensky had already established his anti-corruption bona fides, having introduced a number of reform bills in Ukraine. Fourth, on July 26th, the day after his call with President Zelensky, President Trump spoke to Ambassador Sondland, who was in Ukraine. The one question the president asked Ambassador Sondland was not about corruption, but about whether or not President Zelensky was going to do the investigations. Fifth, the released aid, as your question points out, Senator, the president released the aid in 2017 and in 2018, and he released it in 2019 only after having gotten caught. In the words of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and other witnesses, the conditions on the ground had not changed. So, you know, we're hearing a lot tonight about the concerns about corruption, Burisma, Russia, but the facts still matter here. We are here for one reason and one reason only. The President of the United States withheld foreign aid that he was happy to give in the two prior years, that suddenly we are to believe something changed, the conditions on the ground changed, and he had an epiphany about corruption within a week of Vice President Biden announcing his candidacy. It doesn't make any sense. And one other thing I will say with regard to the aid is this assertion that President Trump has been the strongest supporter of Ukraine. And I talked about this earlier. Let's just assume that to be the case. And if it is the case, as the President's counsel has contended over and over again, then there is, of course, no reason to withhold the aid because nothing has changed. This leads us inevitably only to one conclusion, and that is that the President of the United States used taxpayer dollars, the American people's money, to withhold aid from an ally at war to benefit his political campaign. Do not be distracted by Russian propaganda, by conspiracy theories, by people asking you to look in other directions. That is what this is about. That will not change. The facts will continue to come out, whether this body subpoenas them or not. The facts will come out. The question now is, will they come out in time? And will you be the ones asking for them when you are going to be making the decision in a couple of days to sit in judgment?
Mr. Manager.
Mr. Chief Justice.
Senator from Wisconsin.
I sent a question to the desk for the President's counsel.
Thank you.
note coming in from Darlene in Connecticut as we wrap up. Oh, my fucking Christ. Now Succolode is saying the trial will take too long. I thought he and his partners in crime were bitching about how the House rushed through everything with the impeachment. These poor excuses for human beings are pathetic. Is our fourth estate savvy enough to recognize it and point this out? Ah! And, you know, probably not. Probably not. Well, I hope there've been a lot of, and fortunately the audio has covered a lot of it. There've been a lot of sneeze breaks. Oh, Mr. Succolode is back. Let's take this too.
Is that had national, in the case of Ambassador Bolton, high-ranking NSA. This is an individual that's giving the president advice at the highest level. The Supreme Court's been very consistent on that. That's where privileges are at their highest level. The presumed privilege, actually, is what the Supreme Court has said. And in a situation like this, I think we're going down a road, if the Senate goes this road, of a lengthy proceeding with a lot more witnesses. And then I want to ask this question and just plan it as a thought. Is that going to be the new norm?
Yo, shut the fuck up. I'm inclined to agree with Elbert in Rhode Island. Bob, Trump's legal team has possibly been mainlining 110% LSD-25. I also believe that the GOP senators are totally paranoid of possibly being shot by a MAGA cap-wearing gun humper. I think that is the unstated rationale for way too much of this. They are scared to death of the whirlwind that they have sown. They are scared of the golem that they have created. Frankenstein's monster is out of the basement. And it explains so much of this craven cowardice from people who heretofore referred to Donald Trump as an unqualified nightmare and utterly unqualified for the office of the presidency. So that's pretty much it. Back tomorrow for Thorn in the Side Thursday. I think I'm going to retire to the bed and slurp some chicken soup or something. In the meantime, thanks to all of you who keep the program on the air, whether as subscribers or as a la carte contributors, or in some cases, both. Thanks to all of you who share your precious finite time engaging in this long-running conversation, in whatever manner you so do. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Steve from Georgistan in the chat room this evening. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20 years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.